Svoita, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are John Lindemann.
Johnny, it's great to be back. I believe the streak continues, right?
Yeah, it sure does, John.
Wow, John, we're all impressed by your ability to not miss episodes on the show you've committed to being on.
That's not the only streak we're going to be continuing with John on this episode, but we also have James Jones.
Yeah.
And our special guest this week, since Guillaume is still in Boston, or I think maybe coming back at this point. But our special guest is, you know him, you love him, Mr. Scott Thompson.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be on.
We're very happy to have you, Scott. I was looking for a guest this week and went through several ideas, and I was thinking about maybe someone from Connectivity we could have on. And I've actually thought about you several times. And
when you're alone in your bed?
right. Oh. Yeah. Whenever I eat a vegetable or look at a hockey stick,
yeah.
I think of you.
make a cucumber salad.
Yeah, I do that all the time. But Scott, you have somehow never been on this podcast before, as far as we could tell.
Yeah, I've been like on some like rogue episodes. Like there was the week you guys were going to miss, so we did like a Jeopardy game with me and Zach hosted it. But other than that,
show. Yeah, and you've been on, I think, a couple of E3 things and some PAX things that are like recorded back at the hotel, but... not a normal show, and
ain't here, it ain't authentic.
Is that the rule?
Wow, I didn't know about that one. But of course, Scott is one of the hosts and one of the editors of Connectivity, so you can hear him most weeks. You're not always on the show, I guess, but most weeks over on Connectivity, and so a lot of people hopefully will know your voice and know your personality. But yeah, it was just kind of weird that we never had you on RFN. And I said, let's do it. Let's scare the crap out of them with how long these segments run.
So, well, yeah, because Connectivity, we like break it up throughout the week. We do like little 20 to 30 minute like bite-sized segments throughout the week and then put it all together. And then you guys just fucking like Iron Man this thing. So
yep.
I'm ready. I'm ready to do it.
It's one night only. Sit down for 3-4 hours and crank out a podcast, damn it. And that's what we're going to do.
And I have to say that tonight the Blackhawks are playing their very first playoff game of the playoffs this year against the hated rival Blues. And I wouldn't miss that game for most anything, but when Johnny hits me with a please in an email asking me to come on, I do it. And I DVR the game and stay up to like 1 a.m. watching it after this is over. So
such is my evil power.
Yeah, because I, like you, also think about you late at night when I'm alone in my bed. So
all right.
Let's keep moving.
Yeah, so we do have listener mail coming up later in the show, and lots of good stuff to talk about there. But first, it is new business, and Scott, normally I let the guests come a little bit later so you have time to get warmed up, but since you're a pro, I figured let's just put you on the spot and kick it off with... Yeah, of course.
Oh, okay.
Well, also, I mean, what you guys don't do what you've been playing type segments that often on Connectivity, so...
you guys do it so well, we've kind of thought, well, let's do our own thing. So, I mean, really, that's it. Like, we don't want to replicate what you guys are doing. So, once a month, usually we'll do one just because basically we run out of segment ideas. But,
That's what keeps me from doing game show segments.
Drink. I think that'll get you more segment ideas.
There you go. Okay. Well, I guess big thing I've been playing this week is Mercenary Kings, which is available on the PS4. And I guess for another 2 weeks is the free game you can get for being a PS Plus member, which you absolutely should be if you own like any PlayStation hardware.
Especially if you have more than one, because then it's just stupid.
Yep.
I have all three, and it's overwhelming the games that you get for quote unquote free, but you know at like $1 a piece if you calculate it over the course of the year. Even if you only play a fifth of them, it's still a fantastic value.
Yeah, I mean, you like never have to buy a new game, basically.
Yeah. I mean, you don't always get something you'll like, but I liken it to Gamefly, except it's a better value than Gamefly, and you get to keep all the games.
Right, yeah, as long as you stay a PS Plus member, which is just insane. And in fact, you could argue the value is even like greater now since you have to have PS Plus to play PS4 games online, So I don't even know how that shifts the value.
I don't really count that.
I don't count extortion.
Yeah. The thing is, though, they actually do release good games on it, though. That's the thing. Like, you know, like games where you're like, wow, I can't believe they're actually releasing that on PS Plus for free. Not too long after they're new, either.
Exactly. I mean, the fact that when PS4 came out, Resogun was just right there waiting for you, which is probably the best PS4 launch game in general anyway.
Mm-hmm. Probably the best PS4 game, but...
Yeah, still.
So Mercenary Kings, it's kind of this Metal Slug thing. Yes. I played it once, and I might play it again, but I bet you've played a lot more than I have. So what do you think about it?
I've probably played like 3 or 4 hours of it in the past week with my wife, and... Yeah, it's for sure Metal Slug, but with just some nice like RPG elements sprinkled in there. So between levels, you go back to camp, and there's a variety of different people who will sell you items and weapon upgrades and armor upgrades and like biological modifications to like improve your base stats and everything. So there's this whole sort of customization mechanic that takes place in between levels. And I mean, there's just a ton of different things you can do. I mean, even like just developing and designing your own gun. You could spend like 20 minutes between levels just tinkering with different parts to adjust like your firing speed and magazine size and the kind of ammo you shoot, you know, corrosive or electric or just different things like that. So there's
Do you feel those things make a significant difference when you're playing the levels?
Yes, absolutely. Especially as you keep playing because it gets pretty difficult. So for instance, there's a lot of like armored opponents, the opponents that have shields and, enemies that like drive in big tanks with like drills on the front of them. And the regular armor doesn't break through the armor, or the regular ammo doesn't break through the armor at all. So you have to kind of time it when they put their shield down or kind of jump to hit the driver of the tank and different things like that. But with the corrosive ammo, it eats through the armor. So you can just completely like wipe out armored opponents, without having to do any of that. So yeah, it definitely makes a big difference.
Yeah, that it's a little disconcerting to me to hear that the enemies become even more armored because I played the first couple levels and I felt that the enemies really soaked up way too much damage, especially compared to the obvious inspiration Metal Slug, where most of the enemies die in one hit in Metal Slug, maybe two.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, you pick up all these crazy flamethrowers and homing rockets and stuff along the way, which are even more powerful. You know, say it's similar to Contra. I mean, Metal Slug and Contra are practically the same damn thing. And when I played Mercenary Kings, I was immediately kind of turned off by it just because I felt like it was very sluggish moving through the levels because every enemy, you kind of just have to stop and just spray him for a while with bullets before you can move on. In a lot of cases, they make it very difficult to just skip those guys.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, your health when you start is rather minute. So, like, trying to run past enemies, you're for sure at least going to get hit once, and that's going to leave you dead pretty quickly. And how the game works is you don't really necessarily have, like, lives per level, but you get a reward for beating a level, and every time you die, you lose part of that reward. So you'll lose, like, let's say your reward is $800,000 or whatever. Well, it's $800, actually. Every time you'll die, you lose about $125 from your reward. So if you die, what, 4 or 5 times then, and you get no reward, then that's it. The level's over, and you go back to camp. And then you have to start it over.
That sounds like a great mechanic, because I know the more I die and get frustrated with a level, the less reward that I feel is deserved upon completion.
Get
that,
right.
That really helps to motivate me to push on through this really difficult thing.
G-I-T-G-U-D.
So, yeah, so it is kind of a punishing mechanic. I mean, so, but there is, I guess, then sort of a replayability aspect to it, because as your character is getting more powerful, then you can go back and play those old levels, clear them out pretty easy, and then, you know, get that full reward. You can go back and replay old levels. So, yeah, you can
that's okay.
Kind of reap your reward that way. But yeah, and as far as the enemies taking more damage, I do agree that in the beginning, it does make the game a lot slower. But, I mean, same as I was just saying, as you're getting more and more powerful, those enemies go down a lot faster. So it's not as much an issue. So you do kind of feel that progression there as you're playing. And I do like that. One thing I don't like, Johnny, did you play it just single player then?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so you know, like the sprites are, you know, they look really good and everything's big and bright.
Yeah, I think, you know, as like 2D pixely games go, it's probably one of the prettiest I've seen.
Oh, yeah.
The art is just like lavishly detailed. It looks like a Super Nintendo game on steroids. It's really pretty.
Yeah, I agree. But then an issue there when you play multiplayer, for whatever reason, it does split screen. And so it becomes infinitely harder to see. I mean, that those sprites look great when they're nice and big and detailed, but when everything's cut to, and it's not even like half screen really, it cuts it into fours. Because then the bottom screens, on each half are like the map of the level. And so that's nice because then you can split up. So if it's a big level and you have to like, say, rescue so many, I don't know, like refugees or scientists or something, or find so many materials, well, you can split up. One person can go left and explore and the other person go right. Which is nice, but everything's so hard to see. And for the most part, my wife and I mean, we stay on the screen together and kind of work through the level together. So I wish there was an option to just have it on one single screen, like Metal Slug or something like that, or Contra, rather than doing this like four split screen where everything just becomes so much smaller. And it's really hard to appreciate that, the sprites and how detailed they really are.
It seems like they should have let you, play with one person on the Vita.
Oh yeah, that'd be great. And you know, that I'd have to check. That might be an option. My Vita's probably dead. I haven't used that thing in forever. I should check. That would be cool. Or, you know, if it was kind of like a Lego game, I don't know if you guys keep up with the Lego games, especially ones with multiplayer.
Boo! But,
you know,
who can keep up with all the Lego games?
Just so Scott knows, everything from the mention of Lego games until you stop talking about Lego games will be unceremoniously cut out of the show.
Well, actually, I really like
because in that time, four of them will come out.
Well, that's true. Lego Marvel is actually really good if you've played it, which no one has. That's it. I'm just
they're
talk
all
about Lego
the
Marvel
same.
For 10 minutes. But that does a really good job of when you're together, the screen is focused on YouTube. But the minute you start to go in different directions, it does this real smart, like seamless split, and then it lets both people kind of explore on their own, and then the screen comes back together once you get close enough to each other. And I wish that was a feature they had here. Because it really is just kind of difficult to see. And I mean, I have like a 54-inch TV. Hashtag humble brag. And I mean, it's still really hard to see.
It's like twice as big as mine.
Yeah. So.
But I'm not doing too much split screen these days.
Yeah, so mine in the back of the Escalade, same problem.
So yeah, I mean that's I don't know, but I do enjoy it, and I find the customization elements make it a lot better than if it was just a straight Metal Slug clone. Even though I am prone to those sort of games, but
so this game is from the same team that made Scott Pilgrim game, correct?
It is.
Yeah, and you can tell. I mean, that game also had beautiful sprites.
Yeah, I mean, this is Paul Robertson art all over. I'm just looking at screenshots like, oh, Paul Robertson made this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that they've produced a couple of these games now that are sort of modifications to a genre that is usually boiled down by mentioning one specific game in it. Like not even just genres that were popular, but genres where a single game stands out as the archetype of that whole type of gameplay.
Yeah, with Scott Pilgrim, it was The Simpsons.
Yeah, actually, no.
No,
I was
I'm serious. I think that game resembles The Simpsons more than Final Fight or Streets of Rage or any of the other old.
Well, what about River City Ransom?
Good old Kunio-kun.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. No, it is a little bit, but yeah, I think Scott Pilgrim is. It feels more like The Simpsons to me from what little I played of it. But anyway. So, Mercenary Kings, I don't think this is necessarily a Sony exclusive. So
it's on Steam.
Okay, yeah. I could see this coming to Wii U one day, and if it does, maybe then the whole split-screen thing would work out a little better with the gamepad.
Yeah, that would be cool.
It seems okay. It's definitely getting mixed reactions. I mean, I honestly, I had a mixed first impression, but I have not played enough of it to really form an opinion. I will go back to it, but I'm so behind on numerous PlayStation Plus games. I've actually been trying to catch up a lot on my PS3. I've been playing, I'd say I beat Bioshock Infinite. Gosh, I did another one. I can't even think of it right now. And now I'm currently playing through Tomb Raider, which is surprisingly good. So it's just they've been putting up a bunch of crazy stuff. There's Batman Arkham City, which, John, can we say that thing about Batman Arkham City? Is that cool?
What thing?
That you're in the credits?
Oh, yeah, I am in the credits. Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you have to sit there. Oh, yeah. You have to sit there and wait for about 14 minutes.
Yes,
not that I timed it or anything.
And I did it.
But I am in there, yeah.
As what? What are you credited for?
It's I'm in the online technology platform
ruining
group.
It.
I worked on the website for it.
Ruining it.
So. Yeah. Yep. I worked on the website for that game. So.
That's awesome.
And they list every single person in the company pretty much, top to bottom. Which is why I'm in there.
It's good to have credits to your name, even though you're not really doing game development anymore. Were you? Would you say that you were in game development at the time?
I don't know. I mean,
you weren't working directly on the game, but you were involved in the marketing of it, essentially.
Yeah, it would be the marketing branch of it, really, yeah. More than anything. So it was kind of like I wouldn't say that I was like a dev on the game. I think probably technically I could say that, but I think that's bullshit because I didn't have anything to do with the actual. I didn't have anything to do with the creation of the game. I mean,
I was actually right. Chief designer.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, you could do a lot worse for having your name in a game credit than Batman Arkham City. That's
it's
really
a pretty
good
it's a
game.
Pretty sweet game to have your name in the credits. So.
But that was I know that was a couple jobs ago, so I figured it was okay to talk about.
Yep.
not that we ever had any kind of conflict of interest. You didn't talk about any of those WB games that you were, you know, involved with at the time.
Yeah, I stepped around that pretty nicely.
Yep. You did. I kept a good eye on you because I didn't want you to get in trouble.
Yep.
Anyway, yeah, PS Plus is crazy. So, Scott, what else have you been playing or reviewing?
Well, yeah, reviewing. I mean, playing it is part of reviewing it. But last week you guys talked about it, and I think in the show notes you mentioned that you might have kind of a closing discussion about it, so that worked out pretty well. But Rusty's Real Deal Baseball on the Nintendo 3DS. So I listened to last week's show, and I think, James, you were pretty much the only person who had played it at this point, right, Johnny? Maybe you had played it a little bit?
Johnny had spent money.
Okay.
I had played it for a while. I've played a lot more now and spent a lot more money on it now.
And then having played more of it, kind of what are your impressions now? Because you left off pretty positively, I think, last week.
I'm still positive on it.
Yeah, I'm still I've lost a little bit of steam on it, but I mean, that's kind of expected because there's so many of these iterative minigames in there that it's, you know, if you're just trying to marathon them like I was, you're gonna lose some interest. I've bought all the ones that drive the story, as it were, which is Insidious, and I've bought a single one where you get, which isn't really a minigame at all, but you get to make custom bats.
Yeah, which I actually really like.
That one reminded me of this old Nintendo DS touchscreen demo that they had back in 2004 at E3. Before the DS came out, and there was a game very similar to that. It was just a tech demo that they never did anything with, and I was really surprised to see it show up in Rusty.
They probably just dug it out and threw it in there. What's curious is
they still divered it.
What I didn't like about it was that you can make a bat you can use in the game, but the bat's only even remotely usable if you stay within the sort of the confines of a regular bat. Like, I would have preferred it if I made a bat with a huge barrel, maybe it swings super slow, but I destroy the ball if I hit it.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
You know, if it gave me a little bit more play versus just being the ability to put a different colored, slightly oblong-shaped bat in my hands versus the regular one. But besides that, I mean, I hadn't played this one at the time, but I really loved, like, the essence of umpiring.
Oh, right? That's probably my favorite game.
It's because it's so dumb. I mean, it's super
stupid.
It's
so weird.
But it's kind of ridiculously addictive.
Yeah,
because
it
really
is.
Does force you to keep track of things in your head that ultimately each individual decision's not that hard. Sorry, umpires. but like you start to go like, oh well, that was a ball. Like, oh wait, he swung, but he didn't hit it, so it's a strike. And then you're thinking about things like he tapped it, so actually it's foul. You're just kind of working through all these different metrics in your head, and the ones where they force you to keep track in your head then at the end indicate what the strike and ball count should be.
I like that one a lot, yeah.
God, that can get that at the end gets real evil.
Yeah, it's like a weird like modern twist on Simon Says or something like that.
Yeah, but you're retroactively telling them what Simon said based on the actions of people.
Right, yeah.
It reminded me of kind of some brain training, brain age.
Yeah,
games.
It does have some brain training elements to it. It was kind of like I was surprised at how much I enjoyed that particular one. I mean, the one where you have to call pitches in flight can be really difficult
to kind of like distinguish between like what's a strike and what's a ball.
No, there's one where they teach you what different types of pitches look like fastballs.
Based on like the how curvy it is in the air and
right,
stuff.
Right,
yeah.
It's angle of flight and the later ones of so you get rewarded for being able to predict it faster. So if you can predict it before it hits the plate, you're going to get 3 points. If you do it at the plate, you might get 2. And if you do it after it gets to the plate, you're going to get like 1. So there's this impulse to go really fast, identify the pitch. But even if you recognize it, that can cause your brain and thumbs to kind of get disjointed and you end up hitting the wrong one. So this is kind of this gamble where your brain, you're telling your brain to slow down, but your hand just keeps wanting to answer as quick as it can. It's really kind of insidious.
There's another game. I don't remember if it's in the umpire set or a different pack, but it has you try to read a number spinning on the ball as it's being pitched. Oh, so
that's so hard.
It is hard. The pitcher will throw a fastball and it'll have like the number 6 on it, but it's spinning really fast as the ball comes towards you, and you're supposed to enter on the touchscreen, you enter what number you read off the ball. And as the pitches get faster and faster, it gets really, really hard, and it becomes hard to distinguish between, you know, certain sets of numbers that look kind of alike when they're
all blurry. Oh, like 6 and 9.
6 and 9 is very tough, yeah. I think 7 and 2, I think, is tough. But I thought that I was really, you know, I'm not a big baseball fan. And overall, I have to say, I'm really surprised that they have not only hit upon so many different aspects of baseball to create these mini games, but they've managed to make the vast majority of them really fun, even for people who don't really care about the sport. And I appreciated that quite a bit because, you know, I got into it mostly out of curiosity and ended up buying a bunch of the games because I thought the first couple were surprisingly fun and addictive. And also I wanted to see the story play out, and I kind of wanted to see how the whole thing progressed. And, you know, it got to a point where you don't have to play the games in order to keep the story going. As long as you pay them money, you can keep unlocking the chapters. So I got a little bit behind after a while, and there was a time when I felt like I was playing the story, the text adventure part of it, more than I was playing the baseball minigame part of it. But then when I finished the story, I went back and started playing some of the games I had purchased but not even played yet, and I still like those. You know, I mean, I have no incentive to play them in terms of unlocking items that are useful for the haggling. I'm playing it just because I like to play them, and I still think they're fun. So
I do think it's worth noting that you can earn every single haggle item in the first package you buy.
Yep, just play straight through all the games. Yeah,
that was a very clearly deliberate decision by them when they made the game that you're gonna have everything you need to haggle all the way through all the purchases very early.
Well, of course, every time you unlock one of those items, it encourages you to go try the haggling. Like, it's like getting a new item in a Zelda dungeon. Now you want to use it, except in this case, to use it you have to go spend $1.50 or something like that.
But see, I mean, I think I got like 3 of them within a few minutes of each other. So it's like, hey, guess what, now you can basically go buy everything.
Yeah,
I got the gold Nintendo 4DS system.
Yeah, I mm-hmm. got that.
Yep,
which is just for show. But I also got the gold manager's jacket for buying all the games, and I don't know how to use it or even find it.
There's a screen. If you go to the left of all your cartridges, that's just your wardrobe.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
And you can unlock more costumes too by doing the like the endless modes, the high score modes.
Yeah, I got like a ninja costume one time.
Oh, cool. I haven't even messed with the high score stuff.
I was gonna say that, you know, I grew up around baseball. I love the sport, and there's a certain amount of nostalgia in it, coming from a different perspective as Johnny, where a lot of these things they have you do are the kind of things you do when you're learning to play. You know, a lot of the batting cage stuff, I've spent inordinate amount of time in a batting cage, and it is a little bit nostalgic. I mean, it's obviously not the same, in part because I'm not dying halfway through, but it's 100 pitches, you feel kind of shitty afterwards, but it's like just the timing stuff that still feels, I mean, it's sort of like the best feeling of that when you connect. I kind of go back to when I was a kid and I would line drive the pitching machine right back into its face. And I'd be like, yeah, take that.
And then this game rewards you for it.
Yeah, it gives you this nice little touch where you get more points for it. And like a scrolling marquee across the top will have messages like, ow, and hey, or like error when you hit the thing. Just as a little touch.
Yeah, it's great.
It feels so good to just jam the ball back at the pitching machine. It was so nice to see that rewarded.
I think it's really smart that a lot of these games, whether you're hitting or fielding or even being the umpire, a lot of them involve the ball flying towards you.
Oh, the 3D looks great.
Yeah, the 3D really makes a big difference. I mean, it's hard for me to say that it helps me play the game. It's just one of those intangible things that would be very difficult to quantify. But it feels right. I mean, it looks great. It feels like it's informing the timing, because the timing is pretty strict on a lot of this stuff. I mean, I'm not messing around when I say this game reminds me a lot of Rhythm Heaven. I think some of these mini games are pretty tough. They give you a lot better feedback than Rhythm Heaven does in terms of what you're doing wrong when you mess up. In general, I think it's a pretty challenging game. The mini games, you know, they have different grades of difficulty, but all of them get really hard at some point. And in a lot of cases, I feel like the 3D, if it doesn't help me play the game, it makes me feel a little more immersed, and it helps me kind of pay attention to where the ball is a little bit better. So I really like that quite a bit.
I think it's almost essential on the umpire one, when the ball is coming down the plate and you have to make the call.
Oh yeah, because the game does a trick that pitchers do, which is drop the ball at the very last second, and you have to be able to perceive how late it dropped.
Exactly. Yeah. So no, this is one of the few games where I had 3D on most, if not all, the time. I really hate the 3D.
Oh, I never turn 3D off unless I'm playing.
Yeah, I don't either. I keep it on all the time.
The ones where you catch the ball, where you actually hold the 3DS like you would hold a glove.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And you're actually using the gyro. Those work remarkably well.
Yeah, I think they're really good.
I really wasn't a big fan of those. I anything that uses gyro, generally, I just dislike.
I just thought it was responsive in all the ways I wanted it to be.
Have you, did you unlock Gear Games?
I bought it, but I haven't played it yet. It's, I think, the only one I have not messed with yet.
You would know if you had, because it's terrible. That's the worst of the bunch. There's one, a whole set of games where you're bouncing the 3DS up and down in your hands to bounce a baseball off a bat.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I passed on that one. I saw what it was. Bad. I was like, no.
And then there's another one where you use the touchscreen to just clean baseball gloves. You just scrub them clean until they shine. It's really bad. That
Why would you
terrible.
Shine your baseball glove? You want it to be dirty.
Oh. No, you want to put your calamine lotion in it or whatever. The oil of Olay.
Yeah.
No. You want to put pine tar in it. I mean, you don't want to put pine tar in it.
So the nice thing, and I was pleasantly surprised by this, but James referred to it earlier. You don't have to buy all the games in order to complete the story. It's only five or six of them, I think. There's only five or six chapters.
Six of them, yeah.
Yeah, so if you hear about one, or if you, I mean, it gives you a little preview. Like, Rusty is trying to sell you these mini games, so he gives you a whole pitch. He shows you some videos. He kind of, there's some text that kind of describes what the game is all about, and he really tries to sell you on it. If you look at that and you're like, that's not very appealing, then don't buy that one. You can still complete the game, as it were.
Well, no. So you have to buy a subset. I mean, there are ones that are demarcated as these advance the plot, these do not.
Yeah, there are 6 of the 10 that you have to buy, and that was something that's something I'm kind of disappointed in. I see it both ways, and you guys were kind of talking about it last week, but them tying the story to purchasing the games does kind of give you that push to buy more of them, because
absolutely.
I mean, who wants to come in and just see this like dejected dog in this like a little shop that's on fire because he can't cook for his puppies, you know, like who wants to see that all the time? And the story's funny, which, and really well written. So there's that push. But at the same time, like something like Game & Wario, when I played and reviewed that for a Nintendo World Report last year or whatever, you know, as I was playing, I was thinking, man, like half of, or even less than half of these games are actually really good. And I wish I could just buy them individually on the eShop. And when, with Rusty's, I thought, well, this is great. Like I can see the games I want to buy and I'll buy just them. But when you tie 6 to the story, I kind of felt almost like forced to buy them, I guess. I didn't have that complete freedom to kind of just like piecemeal choose what I wanted to buy. And then I know Rusty does give some description, but only 2 of the games have demos, which is kind of unfortunate too, because then you don't really, I mean, beyond his description, unless you go online and just check forums or listen, you know, to this fine podcast, you don't really know which games are worth buying and which aren't. So I was kind of disappointed in that.
So I disagree with you on a couple things there. First off, I think asking for demos for games that cost less than $2 is a bit much. And I just don't think it's necessary. I think the information that he gives you in the little pitch is generally enough. I mean, obviously he's like, you're going to love this game. Well, you know, you may or may not, but I mean, he tells you in pretty good detail what you're going to be doing in that mini game, and you can decide if that sounds interesting or not. And they show gameplay, so you know what you're getting into in general. And as far as feeling compelled to buy more things. I mean, that's obviously what they're going after. But in terms of buying certain ones, I think the games that they have assigned to story chapters, the ones that you have to buy to complete the story, are the best games. I mean, I think they're trying to direct you towards the best ones.
I think the two fielding games are kind of lousy. I think a couple of the extra games, I mean, like even the bat-making one, I think is genuinely interesting. Now, maybe not to add that to the story, but I find it, I had more fun doing that than any of the fielding. I just don't like it. The gyro, or even using the control stick.
You can at least argue that the fielding games are different and they have different control methods. And so there's something to be said for them trying to give you the you know, to show you the breadth of what the game has to offer.
Of the six gamiest, I would say that those fielding ones have to be in that list. Because I would say a bunch of the optional ones are kind of, you know, they're not very gamey, or there's some other really weird. I mean, I like the bat making, but there ain't much to it.
Well, sure. I kind of like the one where you're batting and you're hitting different, like, targets and stuff.
Oh, like the UFOs and stuff?
Well, I think there's UFOs in a few of them, but, like, where, I don't know, you just have to hit the ball in specific places. I can't remember the name of it now, but, like, that's one I would have rather had than two different fielding ones. I don't know. That's just me. I just, those didn't really impress me.
I mean, ideally, you would be able to buy any, whatever games you want in order to proceed the story. And I'm sure they're going to get some feedback along those lines. If they ever do this again, I'm sure they will follow up on that. But yeah, I mean, overall, I guess I like the game a lot better than you did. I like the mini games quite a bit. To me, it really does capture some of the kind of craziness and the fast pacedness of the WarioWare and the Rhythm Heaven games. And,
oh, yeah.
And I was surprised at how much I enjoyed playing the game. And so what started as kind of a weird, you know, microtransaction experiment that I was kind of doing as research turned into me really being excited to unlock more of these, because I was surprised at how different each one of them was. And I like the vast majority of them. So, but yeah, your mileage may vary. I mean, it's a weird game. It's really, really weird. But it's definitely high quality, and there's a lot more thought and polish put into it than I would expect from a project of the scale.
I mean, I'd say it's better and more polished than Game & Wario, a console release, you know, a full console release that just came out a year ago. So
yeah, which they charge, what, 40, 50 bucks for?
It was 40 when it came out, yeah.
I mean, the best part of Game & Wario is essentially just a Miiverse wrapper.
Right.
It's to see how dumb the average Game & Wario user is with the sketchpad. And the answer is real damn dumb.
All right. Well, we spent a lot of time with Scott. Probably won't need that much for you, John.
Yeah, not too much. Haven't had too much time to delve into the gaming front. But one thing I didn't really kind of go into last week was what happened to my 3DS after its little adventure out to repair land, and it has come back to me. So, yeah, pretty much what everybody told me on Twitter would happen, happened. So all of my StreetPass stuff is gone. So I have to start over completely from scratch with all of my puzzles that I had solved, which was...
And there's so many fucking puzzles
now. Yeah, which was a lot, and all of those... I mean, I was coming up on 1,000 StreetPasses, you know, all those StreetPasses at PAX East... Like the hundreds of them that I got at PAX East, they're all gone down the tubes.
So I will say, if we ever go back to PAX East, you can easily clear 1,000 of them in one PAX East.
Yeah, next time I go to PAX East, you know,
just
whether
sit
it's
under the escalator and just clear street passes
all
day.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm just going to go there to do
PAX
street
East
passing.
PAX East is literally just there's a plug. You can just plug the 3DS in and just sit there all weekend.
That sounds like a terrible use of your weekend.
Clearing the street path, or the best use.
Yeah, I might just hire a child to, you know.
It goes back to Carly's idea of having a booth that she sets up where she just manages your 3DS charging and street passing.
it's
like $15 a day, and she clears your street passes all day.
That is not a bad idea. You know, people would definitely take advantage of that just to get all those sweet street passes. But yeah, so they're all gone. Fortunately, all of my game saves are intact. So I still have my 50 hours of Monster Hunter in there
because they're on the cart,
yeah,
right?
Yep, they're on the SD card. So yeah, so they're all there, which was good. That made me happy.
So is your Monster Hunter digital or physical?
Physical.
So are you sure it's not on the 3DS cartridge?
Yeah,
itself?
I guess it does. Yeah, I guess it does. I just silly me. I just assume that things actually get saved to the SD card. That makes sense to be saved to the SD card.
Some
but,
do, some don't. Well, I mean, I would almost rather it be saved to the cartridge, so I don't have to worry about my SD card getting canned.
Yeah, that's true.
You
I guess it
back
is.
Back up your saves to the SD card manually, but it doesn't happen automatically unless you if you bought the game digitally, then it will be.
Right, because that's the only place it has to save.
Yeah, so mine is – yeah, you're right. Mine would be saved on the cartridge itself. So
there was one game, I can't remember what it was, that weirdly saved to the SD card regardless if you bought it physical or digital. And I was like, that's somebody trying to buy the cheapest 3DS cartridge they could, isn't it?
Was it Resident Evil?
I don't think it was Resident Evil.
Yeah. Anyways, it didn't turn out too bad aside from the kind of the loss of all my puzzles. I still have, obviously – a lot of the stuff on there, all my games were on there. I mean, I linked my Nintendo ID to it. So now the only thing, the only kind of outstanding thing is I have to call Nintendo about Mylon Secret Castle because I bought that with, I didn't, and I never linked my Nintendo ID to the loaner 3DS they gave me. So I have to call Nintendo and I'll have to say, hey, you know, I bought it with this credit card and that's the credit card that's linked to my Nintendo ID. Can we do something here? Can we make the magic happen and get it over onto my account?
Can we keep Mylon Secret Castle as far away from me as possible?
Can you just refund me for Mylon Secret Castle and we'll just call it even?
You know what? No, you don't have to give me money back. Just make it so this doesn't show up in my eShop anymore. I want to go into the eShop and Mylon Secret Castle not be there. What do I have to pay to make that happen?
If there's one game that's worth the extra effort, it's Mylon Secret Castle because that game is all about extra effort. So... It's almost part of the game, I think, at this point. It's kind of like just to troll me. I think the whole thing was actually set up ahead of time by like some ex-Hudsonsoft employee. I think it was all a big conspiracy myself.
So, yeah, I mean, the final puzzle in Mylon Secret Castle before you find the axe is, oh, your 3DS just shit-canned.
Now you got to figure that out. So
for number one, there is no axe in Mylon Secret Castle. Number two, you're talking about the saw, which you get pretty early in the game.
Maybe you've never found the axe, Johnny. Maybe you didn't hit the right block with the bubble.
Number three, the final puzzle in that game is you have to find the real princess, which is a whole other translation problem that most people never even get to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... Yeah, it kind of bums me out because actually I kind of do want to play Mylon Secret Castle because I kind of want to get... past the first screen, so I have to, you know, call Nintendo to do that. But if I have to, damn it, I'll do it. So things are good. So I'm actually looking forward to. I haven't had a chance to do it today, but I'm gonna download Super Mario Brothers 3 and see what else I can grab off
which
the
eShop. Came out for everything today.
Good call. Yeah, I bought it on Wii U because I think very cleverly about a year ago they had it as a Club Nintendo reward on Wii. And I had no intention of ever playing it on my Wii at the time, or even in Wii mode, but I went ahead and got it anyway because I knew that it would eventually come out to Wii U, and when it did, I would be able to upgrade it for $1. So I finally got my chance today, long, long, long after the original idea, and I played half of the first world. And you guys know in level 1-4, which is the first auto-scrolling level, how you can get a P-Wing if you get enough coins? As you
I
go
do
through
not,
that level.
But I'll take your word for it.
It's really tough to do, and I thought that you basically needed a raccoon tail to do it because there's certain blocks that have coins in them that the only way you can hit those blocks is by spinning your tail. But I was playing through it, and I was only actually started the level small and got a mushroom halfway through it, but I still managed to remember where enough of the hidden coins were that I managed to unlock the P-Wing afterward, and I didn't even know that was possible. So that made me feel really good, because before that I kept thinking, this game's a little harder than I remember. It's that game really tests your reflexes, and it's pretty unforgiving on especially some of the enemies, like the boomerang guys are pretty aggressive. They managed to throw the boomerang at just the right time for you to hit it in midair. And, you know, there's no backup items or anything like that was introduced in World. So if you get hit, you straight up lose your thing, and it may be a while before you get another power-up to get back up to full power. So that game is surprisingly difficult, even in the early going. So maybe we'll talk about it more next week.
I think it's probably the hardest of the 2D Marios. I really think so. I mean, I feel like from World onward... that's when you get the backup
items
and saving.
Do you count to Japan? Because that game's insane.
Okay, well, no, I don't count
that's just
Japanese
stupid
too,
hard.
No. But that's, like, unfair. But I think it's even harder than the first game.
It's definitely harder than Super Mario World. I can tell you that because I mean,
World is relatively easy.
Yeah, I mean, of the old ones, it's the only one I've never beaten it.
Oh yeah, same here. I know I've gotten to Bowser using whistles and stuff, but I don't think I've ever played straight through every world in like one
casuals.
Sitting. Yeah, I need to do that. I might maybe now I'll do that.
But it is kind of ridiculous that game doesn't have a battery.
Yeah,
I thought
because Zelda
is.
Had a battery.
Yeah,
and that game's like 4 years younger than Zelda.
And if both players, or if you were just playing one player, if you completely ran out of lives, was that it? Did you have to start completely over? I know if you're playing with two and one person runs out, I think they start back from the start of like that world.
I can't remember.
I don't know if it...
Because I didn't lose.
No, I think it's pretty unforgiving. I think you have to pretty much always start back at the beginning of the world. I know when you... I mean, I know this because I died a lot in that game. But when you lose all your lives, you start back at the very beginning of the world that you're in.
Oh, and any levels you beat become unbeaten. That's right. So like, if you're playing two-player, every level that Luigi beat will be like back. You have to beat him again.
Right.
That's
yeah,
right.
It's a pain in the ass, yeah.
Yeah, but it could do a lot worse.
Yeah.
It could be a lot more of an asshole about it and just say, hey, guess what? Whole game restarted.
Yeah, that's true. At least it didn't do that.
Bowser wins, asshole.
Yeah, and Mario World is for sure easier. But I feel like at the time, Mario World wasn't so much about difficulty. It was more about like the spectacle just because of what a big jump
off that
was.
It was a launch game. The goal was for it to be showy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Mario 3 is kind of it kind of holds like a weird spot for me because to me, it feels and looks completely removed from the rest of the games in the Mario series. I don't know what it is about it, but I always feel really...
It's the color palette.
Yeah, the color palette is really weird, and when I play it, I always feel really disoriented when I play it. Like, it just doesn't have a Mario feel to me for some reason.
I'm telling you this for a fact, it is absolutely the color palette.
Yeah, and also the way the characters look and just the jump mechanics are just... There's just something there that's different about it that I've always had a hard time grasping.
Even the level designs, like, it feels like everything's almost a series of sort of floating platforms, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some, like, sort of cave levels and water levels, but it feels so different. Like, it feels like the whole game takes place high up in the sky.
I actually saw a, what do they call it, where they use RGB values and hex values, and they compared what each Mario game's color palette is, and it's the only one that was, like, almost completely an outlier. Mm-hmm. Everything has this really muted set of tones to it.
Yeah.
Where it looks like it's covered in a layer of dust.
Like Mario's overalls are like almost black.
it's a very weird game. Like they showed the color palette of each game and you could see these massive overlaps. Mm-hmm. But then this one's just way out there on its own.
Yeah. Yep, and there's like a lot of like kind of browns and black and whites and
yeah, grays.
Yeah, it's very monochromey.
Nothing's bright. Nothing is bright. It's very It's like earth tones.
Yeah.
It's very odd. It's an odd looking game.
I wish they'd have more fun with that now. Like I wish in like Super Mario like 3D World or something that there was a level where it was all in that color palette and was set up like a Mario 3 level. That'd be really sweet.
Okay, well, good discussion on Mario. I think we'll probably talk about that more next week after we have a chance to play through more of it for the umpteenth time. But James, why don't you tell us about your new business?
Yeah, so a few years ago, about three at this point, I spoke about Half Minute Hero, can't remember what the 360 version of that was called, Super Omega Climax Addiction or something like that.
Yeah, there was a climax in there.
Yeah, it's all over the place. And what that game was it was a complete remake of a PSP game called Half Minute Hero. And it featured a completely different art style. Half Minute Hero was very much a homage to 16-bit RPG style of art, very much in the Square Enix vein, Square vein specifically. And it also featured only one of the four main components of the original game's story. So at some point in Japan, a version of Half Minute Hero 2 came out on the PSP, and it is a very much a direct sequel in terms of gameplay, in terms of story. They're related, but these games have never really been that concerned about their plot and plot consistency. So, but it never made its way out of Japan. Not super surprising. It was brought over. I want to say the reverse was brought over by Xseed, and then Marvelous brought over the 360 remake. Marvelous AQ brought over has finally decided to bring over the second PSP game, but they ported it to the PC and released it on Steam instead. Which is a little odd, but I understand not releasing on the PSP as it's effectively a dead platform. So they had to put it somewhere. Kind of a weird choice, but I guess it gives them the maximum exposure. So Half Mini Hero as a gameplay conceit, it's both a parody of and sort of a loving homage to the 16-bit era of RPGs. You are a player on a map, the titular hero to be specific, who has to kill a boss in a dungeon in every stage, and you have 30 seconds to do it. And when I say 30 seconds, I mean from the minute the game begins up until the time the boss dies, 30 seconds, there's a running timer that counts down from 30. And you can pay to restart that timer, and each time you do it, it increases the cost to do it. You can find items in caves. You can take these detours to power up your character by leveling it up by fighting enemies or finding items or buying items.
The timer does pause when you're talking to someone.
Yeah, and when you're in town, it pauses. But if you're in a cave or you're out on, you know, looking for an item or you're trying to grind, it's still running.
Yeah, and I think one of the nice things kind of – if you deconstruct the RPG, the JRPG genre, one of the nice things about Half-Minute Hero is that it encourages you to find ways to do things faster, which is ultimately what a JRPG is all about. Because as you level up, as you get new equipment, it enables you to kill the same monsters but do it faster and in a way that lets you get farther away from your home base. And Half-Minute Hero grapples with those concepts very, very directly and very overtly, whereas they're kind of hidden behind a lot of other stuff in most RPGs.
I mean, eventually, you get so strong that enemies on the field, you simply just shoo them out of the way by running into them.
Which is very Earthbound, you know, same kind of idea. Earthbound is not as deconstructive, but
I was taking it to, what's that game we played for Ease 1 and 2?
Yeah, there's some
of that. The combat is Ease at this point, because basically the two parties run at each other and then meet in the middle of the screen and hurt each other just by running into each other until one side gets flung out into space for losing. I mean, it's very, very basic. So speaking specifically about 2, it appears to be more on the length of the original Half Minute Hero, not the remake. So I'm about, I'll say, 25 missions in, and the missions, they last 30 seconds, but really it'll probably restart the clock 3-ish times. So I've logged about 4 hours in the game. And I'm having a lot of fun with it. I mean, it is incredibly simple in a lot of ways. I mean, it just is. That's just what the game, you know, by design, that's what the game is. But at the same time, there is sort of this secondary complexity of trying to figure out, it's like a puzzle mechanic of, okay, I didn't succeed this time, but I feel like I did that as fast as I could. What do I need to do differently to be faster? How do I shave a second off here? How do I make that go a little bit quicker? You know, I was just took too long fighting the boss. How do I get stronger and yet not burn more time doing it? It's this constant sort of mental processing, and sometimes you just get it, and the game does a really good job telegraphing how you need to run this mission. Other times, it does a really poor job, and you need to figure it out on your own. It is nice that this game seems to give you more options. So I just did a mission where I broke out of jail. I didn't have any equipment. And my choices were I could go south to a village where they either make or store the equipment for the guards in the palace and just steal some and just walk right past the guards. Or I could go up to a town that is populated entirely, in fact, by people who broke out of this jail called Jailbreak Town, because that's the kind of humor this game is working with.
That's at a high level, obviously.
Yeah, and if you walk in and you're not wearing the prison garb, i.e. you've gone to get the armor, they say, quote, "We're not going to talk to you unless you're wearing a prison uniform, because it's Jailbreak Town, and everyone there broke out of jail." if you show up in the prison uniform, they give you some clothes and a stick, and you can try to beat the guards to death.
So they're like, you're just not real enough, basically.
It's like, no, we don't trust you. We're just a town. This guy was the mayor of Jailbreak Town. It's like...
it's like Oz, basically.
You live less than 10 seconds walk from the military barracks. How do you still exist? It is goofy and weird, and it feels like it was literally translated from Japanese sometimes, which I think is part of the charm. Even the incredibly, incredibly polished 360 version felt that way. Like, they translated it literally and said, that's good enough. Like, we don't need to do any better than this. And I think part of that's what makes it fun. I will say that Johnny and I actually played 360 version multiplayer for a little while, and I found that to be just bonkers. This game does appear to feature a multiplayer mode, which is nice. I haven't had a chance to try it yet, so I'm looking forward to that. If you played the 360 mode, I will say that the graphical difference is significant. I mean, it's obviously a completely different visual style. I much preferred the 360 version. I thought the cartoon graphics they went with looked really cool, and they were very charming. I thought the pacing was a little bit more it was just different. It felt a little bit different because they cut three other gameplay modes out of the 360 version because it was only a $7 game, so they can't afford to give you everything. So I kind of liked that more so than I enjoyed this. Also, there was kind of an intense personal reason. Like, that was I bought that game right after I moved into my last apartment, which was the first time that I wasn't living in the same building as either really close friends or with family. Mm-hmm. So, like, this is my adult apartment on my own. So I kind of built this kind of secondary bond with
so
that game.
So the first thing I'm going to do is play a video game. Yeah!
Well, I mean, you go
I'm an adult
into your apartment,
now!
You go into your apartment, it's like 9:30 at night, and you're like, what am I going to do? I can't go out drinking. It's work, so I'll buy this really weird, crazy Japanese video game.
Mm-hmm.
So I do have kind of this nostalgia factor, even though this game looks older than the one that I'm nostalgic for. So your mileage may vary. I really enjoy it. I think it's goofy and silly and kind of fun and fast-paced. I will say right now, I want to say it's $20 on Steam. I will say that if I wasn't buying to talk about it on the show, I probably would have waited for a Steam sale. There will be one. And I would say that it would be a wise decision to wait for it because, like I said, this is a definite your mileage may vary game. Some people will probably find this game to be relatively unenthusing. Or I think others will play it and they'll just really buy into what it's selling. So I'm, like I said, not that it's a bad game. I think it's a good game. I think it is very simple, but I think there will be, you know, there will be a Steam sale at some point, and I think it may be worth waiting if you're not 100% sure you want this game. All right, so that's going to do it for new business. If you're wondering why I'm hosting, unfortunately, Johnny had to leave. So I will be taking over the show from here on out, so prepare for the ride.
I swear to God, if I found out he left to watch the Blackhawks game, there's going to be trouble.
Join us after the break where the nightmare gets real. In the next segment, I promise that I will have prepared a recording that would wake anyone up from any complacency that may have settled in during the previous segment. However, due to time constraints, and the fact it is now almost 10:30 on Easter Sunday and I have yet to consume dinner, and I have an episode to get out, it appears that I will not be able to deliver on what I had originally designed. Last week's reading of the Nintendo Download's press release harkened back to an earlier time of Radio Free Nintendo. And I'd like to dial it back to that time to present to you, more recent listeners, and to resume and to revive the experience for our long-term listeners of 2008, when one Stan Ferguson gave the most dramatic reading of a Download's press release in the history of the world. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Mr. Stan Ferguson reading Kokuto Fishing Master.
Welcome to the adventures of Kokuto, Fishing Master.
Oh, God.
Get ready for a completely new experience on Wii. Play the role of Kokuto and travel the world to find 5 millennial fish. Only they can stop the magic cauldron from overflowing with lava and preventing the world from being destroyed.
Brilliant.
Thanks to Kokuto, Fishing Master for Wii, fishing has never been such fun. Use the Wii Remote and Nunchuck controllers like real fishing rod to catch more than 30 different fish, discover 5 enchanted lakes in 5 different worlds from Kokuto's universe, confront gigantic bosses to collect each fragment of the statuette that will allow you to wake the great god Geo from his slumber. Meet Kokuto's friends, sell your fish to Baggy, and buy new fishing equipment from Nero's shop.
Thank you, Stanley. That was truly, truly a masterpiece. For this and more masterpieces, be sure to listen to Nintendo World Report's Radio Free Nintendo, episode 103, James Jones, Box Hunter. I guarantee that you will feel deep shame. And welcome back. It's time for listener mail. And as you, if you may have dozed off in the previous segment, I'm sure whatever it is that I recorded to go between these segments woke you up. Johnny had to leave. He wasn't feeling well. So I have taken over the show. It's just the three of us. We're going to call this RFN After Hours. We're going to turn down, the lights.
RFN Nightcap, maybe.
Get some smooth music going. Invite in some company, some beers, or some drinks from men, some hard liquor. And
you're like, we're gonna invite some men in here. I'm like, yeah. Look, those are the kind of jokes we have Thompson here to make. All right, so
we're just gonna actually screw beer, just gin, the rest of the night. Just straight up gin all night.
So already falling off the rails.
Good.
I had a weird phase where I was like, I'm just gonna drink gin from now on. Oh. And then I think after a while, like, my sweat just started smelling like Christmas trees, so I stopped.
We call that phase 22.
You know that? I honestly might have been 22. Is 22 or 23?
It's like the phase where you can buy your own alcohol, but now you gotta try to impress people with the fact you can buy your own
exactly.
alcohol.
Exactly. I'll just have gin.
I'll just bring me
it's
a gin.
It's a safe choice.
Just gin. Alright, so this is the listener mail segment where we tell you about our alcohol choices and bad life decisions. And the first bad life decision will be read by John Lindemann.
Oh, okay. Anti writes, hi, with the 3DS and Wii U being more or less the first Nintendo generation with DLC support, do you think we will see new characters, stages, or anything else in the form of DLC in the future for Super Smash Bros. For Wii U / 3DS?
So, this is... I want to lay some foundational stuff here. The only game I can think of where Nintendo has included DLC to date that has multiplayer online is Steel Diver Subwars, correct?
You're saying the only game that's had DLC to this point with multiplayer?
Where the DLC feeds into the multiplayer.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Although, then again, how many online multiplayer games do they have?
Yeah.
They have some, yeah. But like they resisted that urge in Kid Icarus.
Yeah, Nintendo themselves, I mean, you could make a case for Monster Hunter having DLC, you know, because they have the missions that you can download.
Yeah, but I mean, do you get things that would give you a competitive advantage against other players?
No.
And it's
No.
You're not playing against other players in Monhunt.
Right,
either,
so. Yeah. It's all cooperative or
yeah, I'm just trying
solo.
To think would they be willing to create a scenario that could, in theory, result in tiering? People who have paid
true.
For content versus people who haven't.
I think this would be more along the lines of what other fighting games have done, which is extra characters or extra stages or something like
sure.
that. I mean, I don't think that they would do anything that would disrupt the balance
extra...
of the game.
Extra stages could be interesting because, I mean, I know, the Mortal Kombat joint that came out last time, they made you download this big giant compatibility pack if you didn't have the extra content, so you could play on the extra content, i.e. you could fight alternate costume Melina, but you couldn't play as alternate costume Melina.
Yeah.
And I guess they could do that. I mean, there is the concern that any character they create, they'd probably want it to be somewhat competent because then people don't want people to buy it, but you don't want it to be too good because then you've created a haves and have not scenario.
Right, so you're talking about a game that's already had to probably have months and months of balancing. You're talking about rebalancing every time you introduce new characters.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked about this on Connectivity a little bit, but I think bringing back classic characters through DLC is a great way to do it. Like right now, I feel like there's a lot of uproar over whether or not Mewtwo's going to be in it. So, like, why not a month after it comes out, boom, like, Mewtwo download pack. And especially, like, other kind of characters that people sort of like but aren't, like, maybe, like, beloved. So, like, maybe, like, Dr. Mario is included in a downloadable pack eventually. Just kind of stuff like that.
Dr. Mario is interesting. I mean, I could see them doing reskins as DLC content.
Yeah. Because
they've talked about not wanting to do reskins in the game, but maybe they'd feel a bit more... a little bit more liberated to do those if it's something you pay extra for, saying, I want this reskin. So let's say somebody, Dr. Mar is a good example. I mean, they could just make it a straight move replacer where they replace his Mario's moves with reskinned versions of Dr. Mario's moves, like they did in Melee, where they turned the fireballs into pills.
Yep.
Do a little bit more detail into that. And then you might not even need to download a compatibility pack. It may just show the normal character fighting with the normal moves.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't have to worry about rebalancing, because ultimately all of these characters will play like a character that already exists.
Right, exactly.
Yep.
Stages is interesting, because they either have to let you play on the stages without the content, or not let you play people who have the stages and create a division.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could do it. Remember, I mean, things are split up now and for fun and for glory, so they could kind of allow certain things to be used in the for fun mode. And
sure.
Maybe not for glory, like.
Yeah, but you'd still create a subset of players who have stuff that other players can't play with them if they want to use it.
Yep.
And you see that in map packs now. I'm just not sure.
I was just going to say, like, a lot of first-person shooters Call of Duty and stuff.
We just don't have a track record of Nintendo's to fall back on to see if they'd be willing to do this.
Yeah.
It's a question they haven't had to answer, because by and large, content like that has always been sort of single player stuff when they do DLC. Subwars is interesting, but in Subwars it felt like they kind of wanted to deliberately create a haves and have not scenario.
Because, well, yeah, and it's totally like analog. I mean, it's either you have everything or you don't have anything. There's no like piecemeal kind of buying subs and stuff. So
right, and like I said, they probably wanted you to feel the pressure to buy the stuff, because you're gonna get smoked. So
yeah.
I should go buy this other stuff.
Yeah.
Getting smoked is a sales mechanism. In this game, you've already committed to paying, you know, $60. So they probably don't want you to feel beaten down by people who have the DLC content. It's a difficult position, because you kind of have to extrapolate based on other stuff that they've done. I wouldn't be surprised to see them experiment with it on one platform first. Because 3DS is going to come out first, so I wouldn't be surprised if they experiment with it on 3DS. And that may inform their decision on how much they do it on Wii U.
I could see them for 3DS, that special mode on 3DS. Maybe they could expand that.
Yeah, I mean, that moves towards like single player content.
Yeah. Yep.
I'm trying to remember. Fire Emblem Awakening had Street Pass, where I think your whole team would get sent to whoever you Street Passed.
Right.
And then Fire Emblem also had the DLC where you can get special characters.
Yes.
And I can't remember if those characters were able to Street Pass or not. I know you couldn't like have relationships and stuff with them.
Yes, they could. And the DLC class, the bride, could get Street Passed.
Okay, so to people who didn't have that content.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't present a huge strategic advantage.
No.
I mean, the broad character is kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
And the, I mean, getting the Fire Emblem classic characters is an advantage, but those were also free.
Well, yeah, that's true, yeah.
So, I mean, there is kind of an analog there. I'm just not sure where they would draw the line on haves versus have-nots. I mean, obviously, if they do extra characters and stages, Smash Brothers is ultimately a couch party game. You're playing with people, with friends in the room, watching the dumb garbage unfold on screen.
Yeah.
So, in that case, there's no real concern, because everybody's playing on the same console, everybody has the content.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would guess the answer is they'll probably have something.
I think they'll do it.
I just don't know
what form it'll be in.
Yeah.
It just makes sense. I mean, you've got free-to-play Steel Diver. You've got microtransactions in Rusty. Like, this is their big marquee title for this year. I would be surprised if they didn't implement DLC, which is another like modern way to make more money.
Yeah,
and it also lends itself to being extended, right? I mean, maybe you could pay for like extra trophies or something like that. You know, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of things that they could do. There's so much content in the title that they could easily monetize some part of it. But I don't think that they would do something. I think it's right when you say that there probably wouldn't be anything too disruptive to the core gameplay mechanics at all.
Yeah.
Not that they would do that anyways, but I don't know if they would tinker with, you know. Originally, I thought, well, maybe they would put out a new character, but I think James is more correct in the way that it would probably be a reskinning rather than mucking with anything.
Because there are companies who absolutely will sell DLC designed to break the game. because mm-hmm. they want to force everybody to buy the DLC.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember what game it was. There was a PS4 game. I mean, it was Killzone. That they released like a 900 megabyte patch just rebalancing the DLC weapons. Mm-hmm. It's like, how bad did they fuck up the DLC weapons? Well, pretty bad because they were way too powerful.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think they're going to be concerned about that just because they want to... They don't want to hurt the image that this game is somehow being sold to you in a partially completed state.
Yeah.
Right. So I think anything they sell is going to be... I don't know.
I was thinking about this the other day. Is what I do like is the fact that they can now actually patch this thing. So if there are any issues with any character being overpowered, they can actually fix that, which is nice.
That's true.
Which you're not really used to in Nintendo games, to be honest.
No.
Right, rebalancing, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's only been one game I could think of. It was a Wii game that was rebalanced, and they did that by like having a file that it went out and read off their server every time the game started.
Well, then you had the Guitar Hero for Wii, where you had to send your disc back in because they forgot to add stereo to it or something.
Oh, yeah, they forgot to make the game in stereo.
That was
amazing.
Awesome, a music game, no less. Awesome.
Can you imagine though if they were patching Smash Brothers regularly? I mean, there's already outrage over like Call of Duty and StarCraft and things like that when like races are nerfed or characters are nerfed. Can you imagine like the vocal Nintendo fan base, how much they would freak out?
If the characters
moved, did less damage, or you know, was nerfed in some way. Oh my god.
Yeah, they're gonna lose their minds. Absolutely.
If they took out wave dashing, that'd be so good.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing. There's stuff like that won't happen now. I mean, probably not. I mean, they could take it out of the game.
Yeah, well, I mean, they'll find it, and then it'd get taken out, and then it'd explode.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's death threats. Death threats will happen.
I look forward to those patch notes and those reactions to those patch notes.
I fear for the Miiverse posts afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens, because, you know, from the looks of things, this will kind of be a more legitimate tournament fighting game, so just because they're kind of catering to that, so...
I don't know. I have my doubts on that one.
Come on. I mean, if they're already using the existing games and tournaments that really they don't really cater to tournament play beyond, you know, kind of like ways that people make up to fit them into a tournament mold. I mean, this thing is actually catering to tournament people, so it's going to be a legitimate tournament game.
Yeah, I think so.
We don't have a lot of Wii U downloadable stuff from Nintendo except for, you know, New Super Luigi U. And is that it?
God, that might be it. I think it is.
Yeah, I can't think of anything else.
I'm sure we'll get a letter, but whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that was their first big foray into major DLC, really.
I mean, yeah, we talked about it last week. That really goes beyond DLC. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it not from a literal standpoint. No, it doesn't, because it's downloadable content. But, I mean, in a functional standpoint, it really extends beyond what we normally define the term as.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. We'll see. I'm curious, but you know, ultimately, unfortunately, we don't know. So
yeah.
Good times.
There's really no precedence for it. So
yep. So, and we're gonna continue on with the bad life decisions. Scott, why don't you read the second one?
Okay, this is from Tripon. I don't know. I'm gonna say Trippin because that's cool. He says, "Hi, I was sorry to hear that NWR and RFN were not able to set up a panel at PAX East this year."
So were we.
Everyone was. I also realize this question may be a bit inside baseball, but a lot of baseball talk in this episode. But I was wondering if you could walk us through setting up a panel for a major event like PAX East. Also, would you consider hosting a panel at other events such as PAX South, MAGFest, Screw Attack Gaming Convention in July, etc.? Or is PAX East your only possible convention you would consider?
So I will say it's disappointing that Johnny dropped out because he's been organizing this for us for the past few years.
Yeah.
So RFN did its first panel at PAX East because actually it was Carl's idea. Carl Castaneda, former Nintendo Pirate Radio / partial friend of the show / disgruntled former associate. And he suggested that we do the panel. And most of us lived on the East Coast at the time. You were in Atlanta at the time, right, John?
Correct.
I was in Atlanta. He was in Atlanta. I was in Virginia. Carl and Obi were both in Florida at the time.
Yeah.
And Johnny was the only outlier. He was over in Colorado. So PAX East was chosen because, A, it was new that year. It was the first year they did it. And Carl felt inspired. So that was what we signed up for. And we were kind of like, whatever.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. At that time, the show was like kind of like a brave new world. It was kind of like the Wild West. Like, we didn't really know if we even had a chance to do it, or...
And there, I mean, this was also the first convention like this since, what, E3 Atlanta in, like, 94? I mean, it had been nothing on the East Coast. East Coast got nothing. There was MAGFest, and MAGFest gets, I don't know, 9,000 people? I mean, it's not that big. So, you know, we didn't really know what we were getting into. I don't think really anybody knew what we were getting into. So we were kind of shocked when we got in. So these shows, when they have these panels, they post on their website that they're, you know, they take panel submissions, and you fill out, you answer the questions they have. They ask you, you know, describe the show, describe what you're going to do, you know, identify who's going to be on the panel. It helps if you've got some kind of credit to go to your name. Mm-hmm. So if you could say, you know, former site director of Nintendo World Report from however many years Johnny did it, and then for the couple years that John did it, I think I was described as like former features editor, senior editor, stuff like that. and he described the show, you know, Radio Free Nintendo. Johnny gives us his Radio Free Nintendo blurb.
You have to pitch it.
Yeah, yep. And I mean, part of the pitch was for us was naming. Johnny came up with a horrible name this year. I think is personally responsible for us not getting the show. I'm not even going to honor it because it's so egregiously awful that he should be extra ashamed. And then you wait. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
But that's the thing, though. You have to bear in mind that you can't just be some random podcast. I mean, you kind of have to have proof of an audience, right?
Right.
Which we already had. I mean, it helps that, you know, we had a website.
And we had an in as well, and that, I mean, I hate to say it was an in, but we knew people who worked at Penny Arcade.
Exactly, right? So
we've had people from the staff on the show.
Yeah. And that's the kind of thing. I mean, a lot of this stuff it's not really necessarily who you know, but to a certain degree you have to have been around for a while, and the thing is just by virtue of you being around a while, you will generally be in certain circles where people will know about you or know about what you're doing.
Well, it's that, or if you are that of course that implies that you're all coming from the same outlet. If you're pulling together to talk about a topic, having an interesting topic that they think people will want to hear about is vital. I mean, they are it's not personal. They're trying to put together there's a limited number of slots to do panels in, and they're trying to put together a lineup that they think will provide a broad enough flavor of topics that will also be of significant enough interest to draw crowds to them.
Yeah.
So if you've got an interesting topic that is that they think people at the will resonate with a subset of people at the show, especially if it's a unique kind of thing to talk about, and you have a group of panelists who are evidently accredited to speak about that topic.
Yeah.
If you're going to make one about indie game design and nobody on the panel has made a game, you're not getting a panel.
Yeah. So I think we checked a lot of boxes out of the gate. I mean, we already had a podcast.
Right.
We were
from already a website. Done like 160 episodes at that point, too.
I mean, and I mean, our website had been around for, I don't know, how many years? Over
about
a decade?
About 10 at that point, I guess. 10
yeah.
11.
I mean, we were pretty much already doing everything. So
right.
There really wasn't much for us to actually do to prepare for it because we had already been doing everything, much like making a game. Well, you know, if you've already made a game, then of course you can be on a panel about making a game because you're already doing it.
Right.
So that's kind of where we were coming from. And I think that also the fact that we're focused on Nintendo helped us because not a lot of people do that industry-wide.
Right, and that was the only real Nintendo-themed panel that year. I mean,
yeah, so it made us unique.
There were like Pokemon-themed panels, but that's a whole different thing.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Yep. I mean, and we I think we said explicitly we were going to talk business, and they were that was at that point Nintendo's business was nuts. it was still in the We Print Money phase.
Yeah,
but they were sort of leaning forward, so we had to go and. We had a built-in extra potential topic there about what the hell are they going to do.
Yeah, and also, actually, now that I think about it, that may be why we didn't get a panel this year is because...
I'm sure it contributed.
Yeah, I mean, Nintendo is just not the hot topic right now.
They're
not.
If you remember, John, that
you know,
first...
Complaining
that first,
about them.
That first year we did that panel, do you remember? We did... It was a smallish crowd.
It was prior to the Wii U's announcement, or was it after?
I don't think 3DS had been announced yet, because it hadn't been, because it was between my first and second D3s, and I went to my second D3 because Nintendo announced they were going to be showing their next handheld at it, because I wasn't going to go to E3 that year. And then it wasn't going to go to E3 the next year, but then it leaked Project Cafe was going to be there. And it's like, no, fuck your travel trips. You're coming to L.A. again.
Mm-hmm.
But so I remember, if you recall, one of the questions we got was a dude in a suit. And he asked about, like, serious-ass Nintendo business shit. Mm-hmm. And we gave an answer, but that was sort of like part of what was going on in that particular moment. There was an additional layer of interest there because people really wanted to know, okay, they came basically back from distant third, and they really weren't distant third coming. The perception was GameCube was distant third, but it was really Xbox and GameCube were distant seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Xbox wasn't doing tremendously better than the GameCube was.
Yeah,
it just got more ports.
They sold did they sell roughly the same? I know GameCube was about 20 million. What was
they
Xbox?
Did, but Microsoft was more successful in North America.
Yeah.
But Microsoft just fucking sold nothing in Japan.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And, as usual, yeah.
And it wasn't... I don't recall if it was very successful in Europe. I don't think it was.
Mm-hmm.
I think they just dominated here, so they had more they had more word of mouth here.
Yep.
But, yeah, I think to that point, your topic that you want to talk about should, to some degree, tap into Zeitgeist at that moment.
Yeah.
And you want to try to be unique, too. I mean, sure. I know that... I mean, that's what's worked for connectivity. I mean, just like our podcast, I mean, you guys are like... You were like the gold standard of Nintendo World Report podcast. So it's like, well, we can't do what you guys are doing. And you guys had your own panel. So for us, it was like, well, what do? Well, let's do a game show. And that hadn't really been done yet. And I think that's what got us in for two, I guess. This would have been the third, but we didn't get in. But then game shows again became popular. And Chris Kohler does game shows now. He had done them at PAX Prime, but then he started doing them this year at PAX East, and well, he's got a bigger draw than we do, so he got it. And I don't think they wanted to do a bunch of game shows.
We cheated one year and had Chris Kohler on our panel.
Yeah.
Yeah, and exactly, and that works when if you got big guests like that, like that's great.
Yeah,
like, that's what you need to do.
And our email to PAX said we will have Chris Kohler on the panel.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, we're gonna get Chris Kohler three times. Okay, we'll do that.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly. Yeah, and that helps.
And I mean, I'll give you. I looked at the panel listing just out of bitter curiosity, and every person on the Giant Bomb panel, which is undeniably the biggest panel at PAX East.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
it gets 2 hours. It fills up the biggest room they use that's not the Megathon room.
Yeah.
And like I said, and it gets 2 fucking hours. And it goes long, and they don't give a crap. Kohler's panel's probably up there, the Retro Game Roadshow.
Yeah, basically any panel that Chris is on gets a huge draw. Yeah.
But every guy doing the Giant Bomb panel this year was on at least one other panel, and there's a reason, because they draw people in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, I mean, there is a certain amount of marketing and networking involved. Now, obviously, I can't expect people writing this letter to just call up, you know, call and be like, dude, I want you on my panel. But it does help, and we're trying to be honest about this. Now, obviously, if you go to a show that's not as big, if you go to something like MAGFest, we don't have experience getting panels there. I would imagine it's I know the facility they have it in. I've been there. It doesn't have as many rooms, so inherently there's less space, but there's also probably less competition, so there's a trade-off. Again, that particular event has a more specific focus, so understanding how your panel fits in and marketing it to that focus will be important towards getting permission to do it.
Right, and you got to look to it like the size of these shows. I mean, I think now PAX East is big enough that it's like, I don't know that, I don't think both are these podcasts, you know, Connectivity and Radio Free Nintendo will ever both get panels at PAX East again. I think it will be one or the other, just because it's so popular now. I mean, the fact that everyone from the West Coast comes out to the East Coast for this. I mean, every outlet has a presence there. I mean, it's huge. So I wouldn't be surprised if
they
we
have
more success.
And there's no news.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. But they're all there, which tells you something. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we have more luck now with PAX South.
I think the creation of PAX South speaks to the popularity of PAX East.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So when they did PAX East the first year over at the Heinz Convention Center is attached to a fucking mall. I mean, it's tiny.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it was jam-packed that year.
It was.
But see, part of the thing you have to realize that at the time –
no one really knew how successful PAX East would be. I mean, if you look back, I mean, now
they didn't even know. They,
PAX
they
East
were...
is massive, right? Everybody knows that. But
right.
back when PAX East was started, everybody was like, you know, PAX out in Seattle is good, but we don't know how it's going to work on the
even,
East Coast.
Even when PAX and, was started, there was that sense of, well, we don't know what we're really getting into. Because yeah. remember, there was another panel, another convention, I can't remember what it was called. It was scheduled for like the same weekend as the first PAX.
Yeah.
It was like, because people were like, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah.
Now there's like five PAXs at this point. I mean, the fact
well, yeah,
that
you have Australia too. I mean, think about when the passes go on sale. I mean, they're sold out within what, an hour, if that, maybe less
quick.
Time.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
quick.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So I mean, when we look at it from our perspective, you know, I think we as a group of people could be on panels at PAX East. I mean, I certainly think we're qualified to speak on them. And I wouldn't, you know, be totally shocked if people from our staff got invited to be guests on panels.
Yeah.
I think ultimately you need to have a topic now. We're going to fucking talk about Nintendo. That's it. And I think now that's almost too broad.
See, the thing is James, you could probably answer this since you actually looked at the panels. I didn't bother looking at the panels this year. But how many of those were not really so much fan focused as they were actual just corporate shill fests?
There were some.
Yeah.
There were some the years we were there.
Because what I'm getting at is I'm just wondering if the show is becoming so big that corporate entities realize that they have this massive reach and massive audience, so therefore the smaller, truly grassroots fan based panels are getting kind of pushed out.
Remember, we went to that panel a couple years ago now where. God, what game were they showing off? They were showing off the remake of I can't remember the old tower defense game.
XCOM.
Yeah, I mean the whole thing was just a sell for XCOM.
Yep. Yeah. But I mean that's the thing. I mean this year they had a one for Titanfall, and then the Titanfall people were on another Xbox One and
right. Yeah.
You know.
No, I mean there is some of that, and I think you're going to see that continue. These are corporate sponsored events.
Yep.
And they will get panels if they ask for them because they are giving millions of dollars to make this thing successful.
And they pack the people in.
Yeah. I think targeting PAX East, I think we'll probably do it again next year. We'll probably at least attempt it. I think we'll have to have a much more concise mission statement than just, we're going to fucking talk about Nintendo.
Right. It was much easier kind of in the Wild Wild West days. It's going to be difficult from now on to get in there.
I think...
Yeah.
I mean, I think a couple years ago when I went through the panel list and we were trying to figure out which ones we wanted to go to, we were sitting down. I was sitting down with, I think it was Johnny, Carly, myself, Neil. We're sitting down just trying to go through the panel list that we wanted to hit. And there was some, like, to get to the level of specificity here, there were things, there were, like, panels on producing your cosplay. There were panels on producing like Dungeons and Dragons accessories. I mean,
yeah,
real.
I mean, true, like fan based, really right. kind of nerdy stuff. But
real tightly focused.
Yeah, small audience stuff, right?
Yeah, and they were put in like Cat Theater, these real small theaters, but they had a real core, real tightly wound mission statement.
Yeah,
and I think that's important because you're not going to go anywhere else to get lessons on how to craft a necklace that you can use for Dungeons & Dragons to be your +20 necklace of healing.
Yeah.
Like, this is if you're going to learn this shit, it's going to be here.
Yeah, which is what makes PAX East cool, is that that's the kind of stuff you're not just going to find that anywhere.
Right.
You know?
And I think, if you wanted to go to MAGFest, you'd need to have a focus on what makes MAGFest important, which is it is in music and games. That's the name of the event. So you'd need to be aware, and you'd need to have a panel that goes to that end.
Yeah.
I think anybody who has a really good idea and knows what they're talking about, and, I mean, really good idea is obvious, but a really interesting concept that is original and really sort of tightly focused and will resonate with even a small group of people who will be really excited about it, I think they have a good chance at these shows because either they're small shows that can maybe find the space, or they're big shows with a lot of venue space that they find something that's really interesting. Even if they don't think it'll get the best butts in seats numbers, they might find a spot for it anyway.
Yeah.
So, as far as what RFN's going to do and NWR's going to do, I don't know that we're going to target. I mean, I think we might take another shot at PAX East next year. PAX South's curious. I don't remember what they're – it's in San Antonio, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah, San Antonio in January, I want to say, this upcoming year.
Yeah, I don't know how many people they're planning for. Yeah. My guess is they're going to skip the Heinz phase for PAX South and just go.
Yeah, they'll go big to start, I want to say.
Yeah.
It'll probably be a little bit more dead than PAX East and PAX Prime are, just because it needs time to sort of organically settle in. And they may be somewhat more conservative with their numbers simply because it's a new city. They don't know how to work.
And I mean, you may also have the factor of, you know, people saying, well, I already went to PAX East. I'll skip PAX South this time, and then next year I'll go to PAX South instead of PAX East.
Next year I'll translate to PAX South.
Yeah.
Because you had to buy your PAX East tickets forever ago, so I don't think PAX South had been announced yet.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. I mean, with us, I mean, we don't get paid to do this, so we're the ones flying ourselves across the country. So
yeah,
that factors into
great
it as well.
For me.
Right?
I've got like 6 flights a day from Richmond to Boston. I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
They're like $90 one way. Whatever. I'll go to Boston for like a weekend if I just feel like it. I mean, it's not a problem.
Yep.
San Antonio, there's not a lot of direct flights into San Antonio. And Seattle, fuck me. That's
yeah, I mean, that's an expensive flight.
I'm committing to a whole week of travel if I'm going to Seattle.
Yeah, and I mean, that's probably going to cost you, what, how much would be round trip? $600-$800 probably?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, from the East Coast
out to
the West Coast.
I know for a fact last year I paid less than $200 to go back and forth to Boston.
Yeah, it's a joke.
It's nothing. I mean, even Johnny, who lived the farthest away at that point, he was in Colorado, in Denver, and there were, you know, direct-ish flights.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I flew out of Chicago and probably didn't pay very much more than $200 to go to Boston and back last year.
Yeah, because Boston has a lot of direct flights. San Antonio is a little trickier. It just is. But to that end, I don't know what our plans are. I don't know anything about the Screw Attack Gaming Convention. It sounds – I mean, it obviously is very corporate-y. So yeah. I'm not sure how we'd fit in there.
My feeling is this right now. Like, I want to try PAX South and probably PAX East again next year. And if we don't get into either of those, I think I'd want to try something, one of these smaller conventions, just because doing these conventions and doing these panels is too much fun to just stop now.
Yeah, I agree.
I want to say it's a lot of work, but it's not that much work.
No, I mean, most of it is the stuff surrounding the event itself.
Right.
I mean, we do podcasts like this every week, so we can pretty much get up in front of any audience and just shoot the shit about Nintendo at the drop of the hat. It's not hard for us, but it's kind of getting there and organizing everything and, you know, making sure everything is submitted properly. There's a lot of work around it.
Yeah. But actually doing the show itself, I mean, you get up there and you think, holy shit, what am I doing?
Well, it's a trip because you're like, wow, these 150, 200 people actually came to hear me talk about Nintendo. That's so ridiculous. This is completely mind-blowing.
You sit down, and I remember the year that John and I had to share a microphone because there just weren't enough microphones at the table. And you just sit down, and you kind of look down the table at everybody else sort of settling in, having the same look on their face of, what are we doing? Mm-hmm. And then you look back up, and it's over.
Yeah.
And you're like...
It goes very fast.
What just happened?
Yeah.
And... It is a lot of fun, and if you have a really cool idea, I know we've got to wrap this conversation up, but if you have a really cool idea, absolutely write it up as best you can. Describe what makes you qualified to speak about it. You know, spend that in excruciating detail. What makes you the person people should want to hear about this from?
Yep.
And submit it. Worst case scenario, they tell you no.
Yeah.
Yeah, they'll send you a very nice email that just says, sorry, we've got enough panels. So.
And, you know... Try again somewhere else.
Yeah, also, I mean, do your homework, too. I mean, don't just submit something out of the blue. I mean, I would prepare for it by writing a blog or doing something like that that shows that you're kind of – you have some sort of commitment in the space. So – because, I mean, if you're just some guy who says, yeah, I like Nintendo. I feel like doing a panel on it. They're just going to dismiss it. They're just going
to – Right, you have to have some kind of presence. Yeah.
Yeah, if you're gonna talk about making shit, attach some pictures of the crap you've made.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Prove to them that you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And that'll tremendously increase your chances.
Yep.
Yep.
So, let's move on. I'm going to go ahead and read the next letter. Stefan writes, hey guys, love you, love the show, blah, blah, blah. I want to put forth the following topic. Is the Wii U really not as big a disaster as Virtual Boy? It seems like they are comparable. The Virtual Boy was a new idea. It had room to fail. It was bold and not really meant to be a standard-bearer console. The Wii U is supposed to be exactly what Nintendo wanted. It's so conservative. They have not taken a chance on a single thing with the system, including its name, which is a sheepish attempt to keep the casual Wii fans. It only has games that were already hits. Yeah, it's a total dud. That makes it a failure 10 times worse than the Virtual Boy.
Interesting. Interesting concept here. I don't know. The Virtual Boy was... Yeah, I mean, it was a failure, but it was so off the wall that...
It's really defining where you want to put the failure.
It's expectations, too, right? What kind of expectations were set out with the Virtual Boy versus Wii U?
What the fuck is this? I mean, that was the Virtual Boy.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody looked at it and goes, what? Why? What? What are you?
Yeah.
You know, I think the only argument that you could make that the Virtual Boy, I mean, he seems to paint the idea that the Virtual Boy is just this, like, outlandish thing. It was going to be a standalone thing and never really be something serious. But I think the fact that they branded it with the Boy name, it feels like it was supposed to be sort of a successor to the Game Boy.
Mm-hmm.
When that didn't happen, that was trouble. I mean, look at the Nintendo DS. That completely stripped the Game Boy name, and it really wasn't clear if that was going to be the successor to Game Boy or not. And
yeah.
So I think they really believed in the Virtual Boy.
And that's like, too, I mean, and after it failed, there was really nothing there to back it up, right? There was just this huge gap of time where the Game Boy was the only thing out there.
No, right. I think the DS name, not including Game Boy in it, is more of a reaction to the Virtual Boy branding. They never intended for the Virtual Boy to be your mobile on-the-go system. Have either of you owned one?
No, I know. It's not exactly mobile. Yeah,
it
no,
is,
no,
it's it not is mobile at all. In the same way my bed is mobile. It's,
yeah.
It's, I mean, to play it on the go, you have to jam a bunch of C batteries in there.
Right. I mean, at this point, the Wii U is more mobile than the Virtual Boy at this point.
Absolutely it is.
Yeah.
I mean, they had no intention of killing the Game Boy, even if the Virtual Boy had been a huge success. It was just going to be another platform. I think they were just trying to reuse their branding.
Yeah.
I think the DS was more of a reaction of, well, shit, if this goes real sideways, we don't want it to poison the Game Boy brand.
Yeah, but at the same time, they knew enough not to do something totally off the wall.
I mean, the DS is a little bit nuts, but
it's fairly off the wall. Two screens, touch screen, folded. I mean, it was
yeah.
pretty off the
wall.
It was
kind of a kitchen sink device. I mean,
yeah.
They said, all right, I don't know what's going to make this next device work well. Let's just throw a lot of shit at it.
Yeah. And it was ugly as shit, the first one.
Oh, the first one was hideous.
The PlaySchool DS. Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of wish they had released that because I would buy it.
Yeah, I mean.
Because it looks so ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think, but you can make the argument that 3DS is a fairly conservative system. I mean, it's.
It is. They did.
They did go
back to 3D. Or at least, you know.
It's been about four or five years now, so it's probably worth repainting the picture. Now I'm going to contradict myself now about it being conservative. I remember being at the E3 where they unveiled it, and they showed it on stage, and of course we had no concept for what they're talking about. It's 3D, just take our word for it. Because it's not really something you could show on stage, obviously.
Yeah.
And they had no games to display, not really. I mean, there were some, but they didn't really talk about them that much.
Even when it launched, they didn't really have any games to show.
Well, yeah. There were more games at E3 than even came out for the damn thing. So they just said, oh, and it's going to be on display in the back of the room we were in the Club Nokia. So everybody formed an orderly line and head back there. We had, the year before, lined up. They had segregated and said, like, a small portion of people get to watch the show live. Everybody else is going to watch it in this theater. They didn't do that. But what they did that year was they put a bunch of Wii demos right in front of stage they had hidden that popped up. So we had all moved to the front, anticipating them doing that again. So we had to move to the back where they were doing 3DS. So we did not end up at the front of the line. But what was weird is we were passing people, including people we knew. I think Nick and Chezza passed us first, former NWR staffers who had gone off to do their own site. And we were trying to get a feel for what this 3D was like, and they didn't have words for it. They just looked at us and were like, dude.
It's 3D.
And I remember when I got it, and then I turned around and handed it off to another staffer. I can't remember who it was. I'm like, this is really weird. And
was that the year they were attached to, like, models who were just walking around, or was that the next year?
They're always attached to models. I have seen that at least two separate years.
Okay.
But they were attached to models that year, yeah. Yes. And it was just a trophy. It was like the trophies you get from completing a puzzle in Street Pass.
Yeah.
And it was just that. It just floating in space.
In 3D,
it was disorienting. So yeah, I guess 3DS wasn't that conservative, but ultimately the branding was conservative. I mean, we've complained about the fact that it's just DS multiple times. I think personally that the Wii U is not so much conservative, because I mean, you can look at its competitors. PS4 is hyper conservative.
Yeah.
I mean, would anybody here dispute that? That it's the most conservative system launched this generation?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just a more powerful PS3, right?
Yep.
Oh, it's a more powerful PS3 that's not a bitch to program for.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
That's the biggest revision Sony made, is that they said, hey, let's not try to jam a stupid processor in this thing.
Right. Yep. But even Xbox One has Kinect and has much more implementation with sort of your everyday like media and entertainment consumption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Microsoft attempted to build... They attempted to take the 360 to its finality of, this is your media device that runs everything in your life.
Yep.
It will integrate with your Windows phone and your Windows 8 PC. Oh, you didn't buy either of those things. Uh-oh.
There it is.
John is the core Xbox One user. Oh.
Just move along, jackass. Don't make me sick Cortana on you, all right? Cortana, how do I kick James Jones in the balls?
Perfect. Do you actually have to address this, Cortana?
No, you don't.
Oh, thank God.
No.
That'd make you such a tool.
You don't. But I will ask her that question later.
Good. She's just going to say, get in line. So I would say the Wii U is probably not, I wouldn't call it conservative, I'd call it risk averse. That they didn't want to put a huge financial investment into system technology, so they avoided doing that.
Yeah, it's a weird system.
But they did invest a lot in the tablet, though.
Yeah.
The gamepad, excuse me. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
The gamepad.
And really, and it's really been kicking them in the face ever since. Because it cost, inexplicably, it's this really strange kind of product where
it doesn't feel as impressive as it is.
It doesn't feel as impressive as the cost to Nintendo would justify.
Yeah,
because it's the most expensive. I mean, it's the most expensive part of the console, correct?
Individual component, yes.
Yeah, and it does not get that bang for the buck in terms of selling the product.
Yeah.
Now, part of that is Nintendo's fault, because they really haven't done anything too compelling with it, but...
Right. I mean, what's... To their own defense, in terms of its cost, mm-hmm. we know, I mean, people on this show are uniquely qualified to speak on this particular topic. We know what they're doing is actually somewhat impressive.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. it's awesome. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I really like
having it. Having latency-free video streamed to another device is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem impressive. It doesn't. You don't walk away from it going like, "Whoa!"
Yeah. Well,
because I think the complexity of what they did is somewhat hidden. It's not something that just jumps right out at you, because people are used to having devices that play video in their hands. The difference is that the actual processing is taking place somewhere else.
Right. Yeah. I think that's the problem. I think if maybe the Wii would come out even just maybe a year or two sooner, but now with the prevalence of tablets and everything, I mean, it just does not seem that impressive.
It's kind of. I think both. Both of these consoles kind of fall in the same category of solving a problem that nobody asked Nintendo to solve. You know?
I don't even know that Virtual Boy was attempting to solve a problem.
Well, that's the thing. It was a problem that
didn't exist.
Virtual Boy
is like, hey, we've got this really cool technology, but it's too expensive. Can we make a cheaper version of it? Yeah, I'll make it only red.
Yeah. Well, the thing is with that, they were trying to introduce... I mean, there was always kind of like that whole... Like, I think Sega had their LCD glasses.
Oh.
There's always been that kind of push between 3D. I've never really understood it. Like,
Have you ever used those, John?
No.
The Sega, they are vomit-inducing.
Yeah, there's always been this push like 3D is some sort of holy grail. And I've never understood it, but it's been going on since the
90s. It's not 3D, it's virtual reality.
Yeah, and even that, I mean, with Oculus Rift and stuff like that. But anyways, but... Yeah, it's just kind of like sort of
well,
like...
Sony on the PS4, that's the most out there thing they're doing with it, is that weird headset thing they showed.
Yeah, like Morpheus, yep.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, and they did it previously when they tried to sell that stupid PlayStation-branded 3D display panel.
Yep.
I can't remember what it was called, but it was just real pointless, and I only recall them sitting on pallets during Black Friday at Best Buy.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, their whole push for 3D TV that just bombed, because nobody really cares about it too much.
And Nintendo's kind of weird because, unlike the other two platform holders, they're not trying to push a larger agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So they take these little experiments that they do, motion control and gamepad, and they're much more focused on preventing them from having to spend hardware resource money. Mm-hmm. They're sort of designed to give them a different approach towards developing a system. So they don't want to try to outspend Microsoft and Sony on building a better computer that attaches to your TV. They want to make it do something different.
Yeah, well, at least in the past two generations.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
maybe you could argue N64, maybe, but GameCube was pretty safe. But yeah, I would agree with that. And while with the Wii it was a hit, obviously with Wii U, I think it is. I think the tablet, the gamepad is just too similar to tablets, and it's just not
right.
as remarkable as, you know, playing with motion control with the Wii and Wii Sports for the first time. It just isn't.
Yeah, right, it's not as compelling.
And it's not as novel. I mean, I think
yeah.
you look at what happened when the other two platforms released their motion control. I mean, Kinect had a little surge of popularity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But Move fucking died on the vine.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because, well in part because it looked idiotic.
Yeah, I mean, and we complain about it all the time. And we last week I think we got a little bit of heat for sort of bagging on Mario Kart 8. But, I mean, that's the whole thing. That's the perfect example where There's nothing unique or novel that the gamepad is bringing to the experience.
Right. And we actually got a response, I can't remember if it was an email or a forum posting, about somebody who compared their experience they had at PAX East with Kirby Air Ride.
Yeah.
They'd never played it before, and they said, while it is a kart racer, effectively, it is drastically different than Mario Kart, and the differences were enough to make the experience compelling.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a 12-year-old game.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, They said, well, this is so much more different than what Mario Kart is doing. It's kind of a breath of fresh air. So when we said that we wanted it to be different and that we weren't excited, it's the same sort of deal here. We wanted to see something different. If you're not going to give us the highest end hardware, we want to see something really cool. And I think the gamepad could be really cool. I think there have been some implementations on the fringe that have been interesting. We spoke about Game and Wario. I think the drawing thing in Game & Wario, I mean, it's totally just added into Game & Wario because they looked at what they had and said, nah, this isn't enough.
Right, but it's like the best feature.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing you access from the menu, and then once you go in there, it effectively does not appear to be part of the same game at all.
Yeah.
I don't even think, is the Wario branding even visible in it? I can't remember. I don't think it is.
I don't know.
I think once you go in, all the Wario branding vanishes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just there to fill out the package, but ultimately it ends up being like kind of the coolest thing on it.
Yeah.
And it's a shame. And I think that part of it is Nintendo came up with an idea before they had games for it. And I don't doubt they'll make some games that come across as really cool
for
gamepad.
But what are those games going
to
be? Because, I mean, they're kind of exhausting all of their main franchises.
Right.
Zelda, maybe, but Zelda's gameplay, unless they change it drastically, which I don't think they're going to do, doesn't lend itself to anything more than a better inventory management.
It should have been Pikmin, but
you know,
I don't think they wanted to delay that game again.
Well, I think too. Look at like the 3DS. The 3DS came out very, very slowly, and Nintendo didn't have a lot of first party content for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And even now, I don't know that they have anything that really like makes the 3D essential. I mean, 3D Land maybe to a degree, but for the most part, the 3DS has succeeded on just like normal standard games.
They went and released the 2DS, so
yeah,
well, exactly. Yeah, 3D is not even a feature now, and in parts of the system. So
I think the 3DS succeeded simply because of the games that came out for it.
Well,
exactly.
Look at the games that are big on it, like Animal Crossing.
Animal Crossing, Mario, Fire Emblem, Luigi's Mansion. I mean, these are all regular standard types of games, sequels for the most part.
Yep.
And now can the Wii U do that? Are they hoping that they can just kind of transition this sort of strategy to the Wii U? And I don't think they can.
I mean, the biggest difference is that the competitor that the 3DS has is a joke.
Exactly.
I mean, John's going to disagree, but the Vita is kind of a joke.
Oh,
I mean,
the Vita is a joke.
I have a Vita. But
it's great. It's a great piece of hardware. But I mean,
John loves his Vita. I mean, he washed it and everything.
I did. I threw it into the ocean and said, you know, if you love me, you'll swim back to me.
Be free.
But I mean, that's the thing. The Vita is. I mean, no one's buying a Vita. I mean, there's games coming out for it, but there's no high impact game for Vita. It's pretty much it's off the grid for the most part.
So it could afford. I mean, its biggest competitor at launch was its down system, was the DS.
Yeah.
So I mean, Nintendo's had some play there, and they could afford to sort of suck it up and get through the hard times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the Wii U, it's got two active competitors. It's got the Xbox One, goddamn it, Microsoft, and it's not doing great, but it's there and it exists and it can get ports of PS4 games.
Yeah, I mean they've both sold what? I mean, Xbox One is probably like 4.5 million, 7 million for PS4. I mean,
yeah.
Look at what Wii U is doing. I mean, compared to their numbers, I mean, what is Wii U lifetime now? 4 million, 4.5 million, something like that, around there.
The Wii U's burn is a lot slower.
Yeah, it has been a lot slower for longer.
Could they release a couple games that make the Wii U a marginally, not, I don't want to say successful, I want to say manageable console, maybe? I mean, they've got to get... The problem is that the longer it goes on, the harder it is to sort of pull out of that ditch.
Well, yeah, and people kind of realize that Nintendo is firing its bullets. Like, okay, Smash Brothers and Mario Kart.
Mario Kart, yeah.
And what comes after that, you know?
Or between those.
Yeah, between those and...
Nothing,
okay, so,
but after...
So the big games on the horizon? Zelda. The big games on the horizon are what? Zelda, maybe? X?
Zelda X.
Which is still kind of... I mean, X is... It's a pretty niche game.
Yep.
It's Bayonetta 2, John. That's your broad-based appeal.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean...
Oh, by the way, I have not seen a Bayonetta 2 trailer in the last 6 months. Didn't make me feel dirty afterwards. So good job, Nintendo.
Yeah, I mean, on Twitter, we were just talking about, you know, hey, there's really no big release for Wii U, at least in the past month. And I was like, wow, how many times have we said that, where there is just nothing released for Wii U in a month?
No, and there was that one month that was like three disc games. Now, we spoke about this last week. I mean, maybe the Wii U... is able to sort of put together a competent library of download games,
mm-hmm.
but that's not really a system seller.
No.
So, I mean, to get back to the question in terms of failures, I think each one failed differently. I think the 3DS. I mean, we're getting email. I think the Virtual Boy. God damn it. Failed in that. I mean, based on things I've read, you know, they may be apocryphal. But there was a technology that Nintendo had in their arsenal that was capable of doing the same kind of 3D effect, but with more colors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a failure of ambition. I think they said, we're going to release this... We're going to be overly ambitious and release this dumb headset to try to capitalize on virtual reality. I mean, it's in the name, Virtual Boy.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a lack of ambition in that we're not going to spend the money to make this thing as good as it can be.
I wonder if there was ever a thought like, well, let's release the Virtual Boy, and then a year we'll do like Virtual Boy Deluxe. I mean, kind of like 3DS and you know, 3DS XL or something.
No,
like that. Well, we can add more colors later.
The cost difference is, based on what I've read, the cost difference was astronomical.
Yeah, and at that time they really didn't do that. They didn't really start that until the Game Boy Color came around. And then they started to do the
Game
refreshes.
Game Boy Pocket and Game Boy Light. I mean, but granted, the Game Boy Pocket and the Game Boy Light needed to happen because the original Game Boy was...
Yeah.
it was bad by that point.
I mean, I think that those were probably in response to the failure of VB, Virtual
Maybe.
Boy. You know?
But I think that it was both a failure of understanding, you know, what makes people play games, and it was a failure of just trying to do too much by not investing enough.
Yeah, probably actually being ahead of the tech, really. I mean, they probably just didn't have...
Being ahead of the tech being viable.
It probably wasn't really mass market viable.
They apparently
viable.
Had something, but it just wasn't... The tech just wasn't ready for mass market.
Yeah. But so all that said, see, the thing is... You know,
you look at the Virtual Boy and go like, well, it's a good try. I mean,
it was a good try. Smaller market.
I'm looking at one right now.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't played it in 3 years.
I mean, that's the thing.
I know it works because
I turn it on
every so often to make sure it still works. That's it.
The thing is, you have to think, though. I think the critical thing for me is that when it came out, the game market was a lot smaller.
It was.
And it was a lot less mature. And for the Wii U to be tanking like it is from a company with Nintendo's history and knowledge of the market, in this market where the audience is so large and the audience is so savvy, I don't know. I think there's a good case for the Wii U being Nintendo's biggest failure.
Well, I think it's particularly jarring now coming off of the success of the Wii in those first few years.
Sure.
I mean, you couldn't find a Wii. I mean, that...
Yeah, it was... There's a million of them, as RFN infamously reported to people who pre-ordered their Wii.
I feel like if we had skipped the Wii, if the Wii U had now come out after the GameCube, it would be...
It would still be jarring.
But it would just be less so. I mean, to know that they came from such highs and now are at such lows is sort of alarming.
The GameCube was... Yeah, I mean, it probably would be less jarring. I would say that the Wii U is... Yeah, I mean, it does feel weird that they're so far divorced from their previous success.
Right,
yeah.
I mean, it's so easy to forget how long they were on top with the Wii. It's so easy to forget that now.
Yeah.
It's about 4 years, but you could see some of the warning signs, because with the Wii, games weren't being made for it by a lot of publishers.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They were focusing on the other platforms and saying this is what we're going to make games for, and I think to an extent that may have factored into the Wii U's market position now.
Yeah,
I don't know. I still think Virtual Boy was a bigger failure because ultimately that brand got shut the fuck down, and I don't think they're going to shut the Wii U down.
Well,
not yet, but I doubt the next Nintendo console is going to have a U in the name.
No,
yeah.
But they're not. I don't think they're going to take the Wii U out back and put a bullet in its head either.
Well, no, they've invested too much. They have to keep it going.
They'll let it limp along, and then they'll release their next hardware platform sooner.
Yeah, yep. I mean, for me, I think the thing that kind of sets it apart as a bigger failure is, and I think really, I mean, stepping back, I think failure is kind of, it's premature, and I think it's very subjective. But it's. I mean, if you're enjoying the console, it's obviously not a failure to you.
I would say there are things the Wii U has succeeded at, and we spoke about them. I think the gamepad itself is a cool piece, is a cool device.
Yeah. It doesn't make your eyes bleed, which is a nice feature.
I can use a Virtual Boy, no problem.
Yeah.
Really? Oh,
for
man.
Hours. For hours. Whew. Which is funny, because the batteries don't last for hours.
Well, what the thing is for me is the amount of money that Nintendo has actually lost on the console. They've lost a lot of money on it, and it's very uncharacteristic of them, because they sold it for a high price, and it's a price that they couldn't back off of because of the gamepad. Because the gamepad was such a huge part of the experience, they were betting everything. They were betting the farm on that gamepad taking off, and it's never taken off, and now it's just an albatross around the Wii U's neck, unfortunately.
But it's never taken off because I don't think they did a good job selling it. I don't think they've done a good job using it.
Yeah, they haven't.
And I still think they could do something that makes it seem more appealing than it does now.
Yeah.
I just don't know what that is. But then again, I'm not paid the big bucks to figure out what that is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I find that one issue is I think the gamepad's in sort of this nebulous kind of gray area where we've admitted that the tech is actually rather impressive for all the streaming that it's doing, for everything being done on the console. But if you have like an iPad or any other tablet, the gamepad instantly feels limited in that, like, well, I can't have, like, take my gamepad to the kitchen with me and use it to, like, look up a recipe because it loses signal and, like, that's it. You know, I can't, like, watch Netflix, two rooms over. I mean, some people have that luck, but a lot of people don't. And so instantly it feels like it's a step behind, even though the technology is rather impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it comes across as kind of a one-trick pony.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. Like, I couldn't use the gamepad in my old apartment. Like, because there was... It was an apartment full of, you know, upper middle class young adults, you know, a couple years out of college. There were like 800,000 wireless devices in that apartment.
Yeah.
And it just flipped the fuck out constantly.
Yeah.
And once I moved into the house, it was no longer an issue. But I literally couldn't use the gamepad. It would just get – it would disconnect constantly because of all the crap going on through the air.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, for me, I thought my gamepad was defective. I mean, I went through the process, and then the Nintendo rep said, well, have you used it somewhere else? And I said, no. And he's like, give it a shot. And I was like, oh, shit. It works great. I had to practically Faraday cage my apartment to make the damn thing work. But I think that's a good point. It does feel limited if you look at it as a tablet. If you look at it as a controller, it feels insane. So it's kind of a weird mix of marketing. Is it a tablet or is it just a really, really jacked up controller?
Right? Yeah, and I think Nintendo's always struggled to sell it like that. People are like, oh, well, it's an iPad. It must do iPad stuff.
No.
Well, no, it doesn't.
I mean, I think it is a jacked up controller. That is what the gamepad is. I mean, it's in the name to an extent, but I think the iconography that it is using is not of a video game controller, mm-hmm. and I think that is the problem.
Yep.
I still think that they need to come out with something that makes the gamepad make any goddamn sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that is. And I mean, there are things I could think of going back to the old GBA GameCube connectivity stuff. Like, they might need to get their head back into that game.
Yeah.
Remake some of those or something.
Well,
but
see, that's the thing. The thing is that stuff like that, though, the problem that Nintendo has there is that kind of stuff caters to the audience that they already have.
True. Yeah, but those people haven't bought the system either.
Yeah, I mean that's a separate problem. Well, I mean it's all the same problem.
But that's a problem in itself, right?
Those
people, but selling them a fucking console would be a start.
Yeah, I mean, like, look how long it took me to buy a Wii U, and that was just because they didn't really have anything that compelling. I mean, things would be better. Yeah, I mean, things are going to be better, you know, coming into this Christmas because they'll have a bunch of their huge titles out. But
right, and I'm sure they'll announce something else at E3 we don't know about that'll be out by then, and it'll be cool.
Yeah.
And
yep.
I mean, they did release. Was Donkey Kong this year? It was the very beginning of this year, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so they'll put out 5-6 big games this year which it may not seem like a lot, but compared to the GameCube years, that's kind of a high-ish number for Nintendo.
Yeah.
In terms of marquee titles for their system, but that's because they let other people do it too. And right now, they are the only horse pulling that cart.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But you can say that, but on the Virtual Boy, there was never any other horses on that cart, so maybe that's the difference.
Yeah.
That cart's best number two was Ocean. And if you've ever played an Ocean Interactive game, I am sorry.
Yeah. I feel like with Wii U, I mean, you know, I hate to be so kind of down on it, but I feel like it's really a lot of the kind of stuff that we always questioned Nintendo about over the years has finally come back to really, really
it's,
hurt them.
It's manifest
yeah.
in this one.
It's like every single thing where they banked on it before and they hit the jackpot, well, their luck has ran out with the Wii U. You know? Oh, a neat controller and that you can do cool stuff with? Okay, well, they finally made a neat controller that the market really didn't pick up on and didn't really respond to. And
right.
all the third parties that they didn't really care, but they were selling tons of consoles, so they couldn't care less if third parties left. Well, now they're not selling consoles, and they could really use those third-party games. So that's coming back to kill them. And, oh, the fact that this is the first console where they really made it cost a lot of money for them, well, it's kicking them in the head now because they're losing money on every single console they sell, which is not like them. And their only choice is to bundle stuff. They don't want to drop the price because then they're losing even more money. So it's just all – it's like this – pretty much the Wii U is – it's Nintendo's worst nightmare come true. So – but yeah.
Yeah. I mean the one thing though that I think may set them apart and make the Wii U not so much failure as we're making it out to be
mm-hmm.
is the statistic that they only have to sell 2 games or 1 digital game and they've made a profit after a system sale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not – the Wii is not like, oh god, everyone they sell is a disaster.
Yeah, you know, it's easy for them to do that because what are you going to buy? Smash Brothers? You're going to buy Mario Kart 8? I mean, everybody's going to buy those games.
I think the issue isn't so much that they're not. The issue isn't so much that they can't make the system viable.
They're in break-evenville right now.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to sell. You're going to buy a game when you buy the system. Mm-hmm. That's just part of. Why would you not?
Yes.
I'm going to buy this system to fuck with Nintendo's
The gamepad is enough for me.
Yeah. I just want to get in on that Miiverse shit.
I want to use that Nintendo TV. But they need to see people to buy the systems.
Yeah.
And I think around Christmas time, we're going to see a price drop. We're going to see – what's it at now?
Yeah.
300?
I think. I mean, I think the time is right where – because, I mean, it's pretty obvious they've been holding out for their production costs to come down.
Right.
You know, so they can drop the price on it, and I think they'll do that as soon as they can.
And for games to be out there people want. I mean, a price drop when people still don't want the system isn't going to help you. So if Smash Brothers and Mario Kart is out, then yeah.
Yeah,
I was going to say, maybe a price drop or maybe just a bundle with Smash Brothers I think would be huge.
I think you do the price drop for the base console and then you bundle it at the current price with Smash Brothers.
Yeah for Christmas, definitely. A Christmas bundle
with
Smash Brothers.
And I think you could say, look, you buy this, And then you go by Mario Kart 8, mm-hmm. 9, 10, whatever. it should be 10.
Yeah.
You go by Mario Kart 10, and then Nintendo's broken even on the console again.
Yeah. I mean, I think we'll see Christmas
consoles
bundle
in
with
houses
Mario Kart 8.
So they can sell you stuff digitally with the stupid profit margin they get on digital sales. Mm-hmm. I mean, keep in mind, if you buy a Nintendo game digitally, guess how much of that money goes to somebody else? Anyone want to make a guess?
Zero.
None of it.
None of it.
So, I mean, it's.
Yep.
I mean, really, that's what they need. They would almost be better off giving you the system if you promise to spend $200 in Nintendo points.
Yeah. Well, you know, or give you a pack in a hard drive with games preloaded on it or something like that.
No, but then you wouldn't buy the games.
True.
Yeah, that wouldn't work.
True.
They just need to say, all right, I'll tell you what. We'll give you a system if you buy $400 worth of credit on the system right away. But then you're moving into like the marketing strategy of the Phantom, and we saw how that went well for Infinium Labs, so we're not going to go there.
Let's just make the Wii U boot into the eShop.
There you go.
Yep.
It kind of does now.
Sort of. I mean, Miiverse, yeah, and then you can click an icon and then go straight to the eShop page for it, which is cool.
We might have more on that topic in an upcoming week if I ever finish writing this stupid thing. So... I think that's going to have to do it for this question. And in fact, the show.
Yeah.
We're getting a little long here, and I'm going to have to edit this week, so I'm going to be super judicious about how long the show gets. I want to thank Scott for filling in for us.
Yeah, happy to be on. Thanks for having me.
I want to thank John for keeping his incredible streak of, what, six games?
Six episodes.
Six episodes, I think. Yeah.
It's all a game, John. It's all a game.
It is. Life is one big game, buddy. I'm just trying to play.
Nice.
Just like roll them bones. Like a Hot Topic t-shirt somewhere.
Roll them bones. Like I said, sorry Johnny couldn't stay with us, so I hope you enjoyed RFN After Dark. Let's go back and do all the plugs. Scott, why don't you go ahead and plug what you've got coming on for connectivity this week.
Yeah, well, this is basically our big like PAX recap. Neil and the boys, it was Neil, Zach, the other Zach, Guillaume was there. And I think and Alex Coffey and maybe a couple others actually. They recorded probably like two or three segments at PAX. So I think the show's gonna be like over 2 hours long of just crazy PAX content. So you can find Guillaume there this week and everything else from PAX. So
I wish we could find Guillaume this week. edit the show for me.
Well, yeah, from what I've seen, he's in Quincy, Massachusetts, my old stomping ground, so
nice.
Good luck with that. Guillaume.
God, why did they stay in Quincy?
Quincy, Mass, baby.
Oh, they just couldn't stand staying in the town. That's all.
No.
So again, that's connectivity. It's got its own RSS feed you can subscribe to. If you're not subscribing to ours, please do as well because we need them downloads. and of course, listener mail. So you can send your mail to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I know I was supposed to plug that at the start of the show, so I'll be editing me saying rfn@nintendoworldreport.com into the start of this segment, and we will all pretend like I said it to begin with. Of course, we are still finishing up the virtual console. Oh, virtual console, crap. We are still finishing up our retroactive for Nintendo Wi-Fi connection, the game being GoldenEye. So remember that there is a thread in the podcast section of our forums where we are listing our friend codes. John, have you posted your GoldenEye friend code in there?
Not yet. I don't even know if I'll be able to take part in this. I don't really have anything set up at the moment.
I'm sad.
Yeah.
Scott, if you have GoldenEye, I encourage you to post your friend code in there.
I used to have it. I don't know if I do anymore. I'll have to check.
God.
I know. Maybe I'll
post my friend code in there because I haven't done it either, so I'm just trying to shame you guys before I let out that blow. Mm-hmm. I haven't done it, though, because I forgot. So I'll be posting mine in there right after we finish recording this episode, and I will attempt to schedule something for this weekend. So after you've already, before you, I will attempt to schedule something for this week, because if I say this weekend, this will have happened before the episode
yes.
goes out. So I will attempt to schedule something for early this week. We'll be talking about it probably next week. I don't have my marching orders from Johnny, but Guillaume will be back, so that may be our time to do it. We still have a little bit of time before the Wi-Fi connection goes down, so let's go ahead and push the thing to its limits and make an alarm bell go off somewhere at Nintendo's.
Pushing this thing to its limits probably doesn't take much.
Yeah.
They'll be going, why are there 8 people playing GoldenEye? What's going on?
Yeah. And you know if it goes down, they're going to be really concerned.
Yeah, oh no.
They're going to be like, okay, I guess we can shut it off early. We're out of here.
Priority 2, it's gone down. Oh no.
I wonder if remember when they finally shut down all the like original Xbox servers. There were people who stayed in a Halo 2 match to keep it extended. They couldn't shut it down with them in there. I wonder if you guys could do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, Microsoft said, "All right, we're going to keep it up until you guys all sign off." And they're like, all right, well, fine,
we'll stay in.
That's classic.
Eventually, I think the last person who was on got some kind of dumb award on their 360.
Yeah. There you go.
But we won't be doing that because we're playing GoldenEye. Nintendo could barely function at having awards on the Wii U. Fuck on the Wii.
Yeah.
That ain't happening.
Yep.
No Chivos on Wii. But remember, you can go and post your friend code in there, and you can go plan some matches with other forum members and ourselves, and I am fucking up this conclusion. So we're going to go ahead and wrap it up there. So, gentlemen, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, James.
Thank you, John.
It's always a great
time.
Thank you, Scott. It's always a great time with my buddy James Jones.
he's so sincere.
I am.
And we'll see you all next week.
Bye.
Later.
Later.
That's fine. We won't do a now playing this week. I'll come up with something else. So it may not be as dumb as what I did last week.
People love that though.
The only person who knew what was coming was John. I had sent John the audio like 2 days before it went into the episode.
Well, and my first reaction to it was, you know, this is funny, but it's just way too long for some sort of interlude. But then he's like, well, it's already in the show, so, and I'm just like, okay, we'll see how it goes.
What's funny is I actually recorded the legal disclaimer at the end. It's like four paragraphs long, but I read it at about 120 words a minute. Like that's the speed I actually read it at.
Yeah.
Like, and I was actually saying the words, and then I sped it up again in the audio about like 6x speed, and it just sounded like a tornado was going off and it was consuming the chipmunks. It was like, no, I can't include this. It's too stupid. I thought John would enjoy the G series interlude music.
Yeah, it was good stuff.
I had to be real careful about what part of that song I used, because he drops the N bomb like 41 times in that song.
Yeah.